Good morning. Thank you all for coming and welcome to Kingman, Arizona. For those of you joining us online, we always love coming up here. We enjoy this part of the country and having all the support we get from this region and you good folks. Based upon that, what we'd like to do is start the meeting, have Commissioner Buchanan lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, if you'd all stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
If you would remain standing. Since the last commission meeting, Governor Katie Hobbs has ordered U.S. and Arizona flags to fly at half-staff to honor the life and legacy of Pope Francis. This order is in conjunction with President Donald Trump's proclamation for flags to be lowered April 21st through the day of internment, April 26th. Governor Hobbs also ordered flags at all state buildings be lowered to half-staff on Sunday, May 4th, in honor of National Firefighters Memorial Day, and Monday, May 5th, in honor of Arizona Peace Officers Memorial Day. A moment of silence, please. Thank you all. Please be seated. At this time, I'll start to my left and we'll go through introductions. Commissioner Guggenhauer.
Good morning. James Guggenhauer, Payson, Arizona.
Good morning. Marsha P. Presu, Scottsdale, Arizona.
Good morning. Clay Hernandez, Tucson, Arizona.
Jeff Buchanan, Patagonia, Arizona.
Good morning. Kurt Kerr, Pine Top, Arizona.
Good morning. Kingman and Mojave County, Tom Finley, Director.
Good morning. Joshua Hurst, Deputy Director.
And good morning, everyone. Luke Thompson, Special Assistant to the Director.
Good morning, General Counsel.
Clay Crowder, Assistant Director for Wildlife Management Division.
Good morning, Jared McFarland, Field Operations Assistant Director.
Good morning, Kelly Tharp, Acting Information Education Recreation Division Assistant Director.
Good morning, Jennifer Alspa, Acting Assistant Director for Support Services Division.
And at this time, I'd like to acknowledge that we have a number of regional supervisors here joining us today. Larry Phoenix from Flagstaff, Aaron Hartzell from Pine Top, Karen Klima, you're one and only here in Kingman, Danielle Klaus from Yuma, and Chriselle Colvin from Mesa, and finally, Dave Daniels, our most recent from Region 5 down in Tucson. At this point, is Ed Sanchez here? Ed, if you would start your or do your introductions, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, Ed Sanchez with the Game and Fish Department. I would like to start with ladies first, maybe. I would like to give a moment for the state senator here locally and in this area, along with the two supervisors, an opportunity to speak and present themselves to the commission.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I'd like to introduce, right at this moment, Senator Hilde Angus.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Mojave County. It's so good to see you. Ed told me that you're coming down, asked if I would come and say a few words, and was lucky enough that we have been recessed for a little while, and so I was able to be here today. And I didn't want to miss it because Arizona Game and Fish is my favorite agency. Without going into too much detail, about a decade ago, Tom Finley remembers, we worked closely to overturn a federal policy that would have destroyed our fishing industry here in Mojave County. It was one of the prize successes in my career thus far, and I worked with the board at the time. Kurt Davis was the head of it. We're still friends today, and we won awards together, and I just can't speak more highly of the Arizona Game and Fish Commission, because you do great work, the whole agency. And the good news is you don't, down there at the legislature, I don't really hear that much about it, which is always a good thing. When you hear about an agency all the time, that's never a good thing. And, you know, you keep low and below the surface. There was a piece of legislation that came up before us. I think you're all familiar. I don't know exactly how you feel about it. But because of my relationship, my great relationship with Arizona Game and Fish, I was able to call some of my friends on the board and ask them. And that's the way you should do it as a legislature. You should call the people it's going to affect, see what they think, how it's going to play out, you know, in practice, not just theory. And I was, think I was given very good advice, and we were able to kill that bill. So, again, I want to thank you. I can't wait to hear what you guys, what your issues are. And, I do this every time I can publicly. I want to thank Arizona Game and Fish for all the help they've given me for the last 12 years in my career and then in my personal friendships. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, next up is District 1 Supervisor Travis Lingerfelter.
Good morning, Chairman, Board Members, Staff. Travis Lingerfelter, Mojave County District 1 Supervisor, also Chairman of the Board. On behalf of the Board, I just want to welcome you. We're thrilled to host you today. My district is the largest geographical district in Mojave County. It's if you were to draw a line right down the middle of Mojave County, I'm everything to the east, all the way up to the Utah border. And Game and Fish does important work in my district. I just want to thank you for that partnership. Thank you for the good work that you do, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Mr. Chairman, last but not least, and I think many of Game and Fish department and staff know this person, district supervisor, newly elected back in December, Don Martin.
Would you step there, Don?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Commissioner, staff, and honored guests. My name is Don Martin, and I am the Region 4 supervisor for the Mojave County Board of Supervisors. I have a long history of being associated with the Arizona Game and Fish. As I look around, there's a lot of you that I have worked with in the past on different things, and you know, I've watched some of you, like Luke, actually grow up within his duties. And I can tell you, I don't know a finer man than that guy right there. I've had the opportunity to watch him when he started and now where he's at. And I couldn't be more proud of him as a citizen of Mojave County. Luke has always done an outstanding job, as is Tom. Tom's the boss now. And Tom started here in Region 3. So, you know, I look around, Gene Elms is here. He was in Region 3. So I got to know a lot of people here over the years that I was a government liaison for the Mojave Sportsman Club, and I served as a volunteer hunter ed instructor for over 25 years, something I'm very, very proud of, and we do have the best hunter ed program in the nation, bar none. Before I start this meeting, I want to give you a little background on the outdoor recreational opportunities in Mojave County. We are the fifth largest county in America, and the second largest county in landmass in Arizona. Within our boundaries is the wildlife that you, the Arizona Game and Fish Commission, and the department manage for all of our citizens. Mojave County is well known for being home to some of the best hunting and fishing in Arizona. Mojave County has over 1,000 miles of shoreline along the Colorado River and three major lakes on the Colorado River. Those lakes, Mead, Mojave, and Havasu, form the western boundary of our county and state and provide anglers with lots of areas to fish and many species to fish for. I'll start at the north and I'll kind of work my way down and we'll talk about what we've got. Willow Beach below Hoover Dam provides a tremendous trout fishery, and huge striped bass are routinely caught from the dam south to Lake Mojave. Lake Mojave has also become one of the premier smallmouth bass lakes in the Southwest, with typical 5 limit catches of smallmouth weighing in at over 20 pounds, and that's unheard of. Below Lake Mojave, the Colorado River flows south, and the current state channel cat fish record was caught in Topak Marsh. Further down the river flows into Lake Havasu, and the current world record red ear sunfish was caught in Lake Havasu. It also produces heavyweight catches of largemouth and smallmouth bass. Lake Havasu has produced double-digit striped bass catches in the past, and one of the best-kept secrets is the flathead fishery that exists in that lake. On the southern border of Mojave County is Alamo Lake, one of the premier largemouth bass and crappie lakes in Arizona. Let's talk about the hunting, which is a passion of mine. When it comes to hunting giant mule deer, Unit 13B in Mojave County is at the top of the list from sportsmen from all over the world. Until recently, auction tags for these giant bucks brought in, over the years, millions of dollars for conservation. Mojave County used to boast of having the largest native desert bighorn sheep population in Arizona. Disease has taken a toll on these herds, and they are struggling, but some of the largest Nelson Eye rams ever taken have been taken in the rugged Black Mountains in western Mojave County. The hunting and fishing opportunities available for sportsmen have been responsible for bringing in millions of dollars into the economy of Mojave County and the state of Arizona. The success of our wildlife populations in Mojave County and the state of Arizona are due to the management efforts of the Arizona Game and Fish Department and the Commission working in concert with various conservation groups to ensure that Arizona's wildlife, which in my opinion is arguably the state's most valuable natural resource, will be here in perpetuity. On behalf of the citizens of Mojave County and of the Mojave County Board of Supervisors, thank you all for coming to Kingman for this meeting, and thank you all for what you do for wildlife in our county and state. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. At this point, I think we will proceed with our awards. Started to say certificate of appreciation. If I could have Carly Weideman come up, please. Carly's joined by her mother, Deb, daughters, Lily and Mina, and boyfriend, David. Why don't y'all come up, too? Thank you. Carly has been terrestrial non-game specialist in Kingman for the past 3 years. She has truly excelled in this role, consistently demonstrating exceptional skills, a strong work ethic, and an unwavering commitment to excellence. Carly self-initiated a goldfish eradication project at one of Arizona's 4 relic leopard frog refuge sites. Relic leopard frogs are a species of greatest conservation need in Arizona and remain at risk due to habitat loss and non-native predators. Goldfish removal efforts began in spring 2023 and are ongoing. Many hours have been dedicated to manual trapping efforts and goldfish-related research, as well as consistent coordination and collaboration with external partners. Carly has also made significant inroads with the sport falconry community. She has built rapport with the falconers by attending annual falconry events. Her consistent and calm explanation of the falconry department rules have increased trust between the community and the department. Within the last 3 years, Carly has gone from 0 raptor handling experience to being on the federal banding permit for trapping and banding raptors. By dedicating her time, knowledge, and experience, She has been able to efficiently train department colleagues and interns to trap and band raptors. Her heavy involvement with this project provides relief to other staff who can then dedicate their time to additional statewide priorities. Not only has Carly excelled in the biological aspect of her position, she is also involved with outreach. As part of the Mojave County Library's annual summer reading program, Carly organizes 2 to 3 public presentations each summer in Kingman. This is a perfect opportunity to provide public education to members of our local community. Thank you, Carly, for your passion and dedication to wildlife and the region. For your outstanding work ethic and commitment to conservation, the Arizona Game and Fish Commission is honored to present you with this certificate of appreciation. Our next award is the Certificate of Commission Appreciation for the Tri-State Shooting Park, and the recipient will be the President, Robbie Love. How you doing? Good to see you. Thanks. Tri-State Shooting Park has been a member of the Arizona Game and Fish shooting ranges since 2013. They offer rifle, pistol, and clay target shooting to the public and have been actively involved with youth hunters and shooters by offering hunter education courses and scholastic clay target programs. This year, they were integral in the department's annual Pintail Slough Youth Waterfowl Camp. The Pintail Camp features educational and hunting components. During the camp, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Game and Fish personnel instruct students in waterfowl identification and hunting regulations at Topic Elementary. The students also receive hands-on shotgun shooting instruction and then use their new skills in the hunting blinds at Pintail Slough during the hunt. In previous years, the shooting portion of the camp was done in the desert with volunteers. However, due to last-minute cancellations by the shotgun instructors, the 2025 camp was desperately trying to fill the shooting portion for a safe and educational camp. The Tri-State Shooting Park stepped up to fill that void with limited notice. The range masters and scholastic clay target coaches stayed after hours at the range to assist the 15 youth hunters with learning how to shoot moving targets and safely manipulate shotguns. Due to their assistance, we were able to give more one-on-one coaching to the youth hunters. The practice and coaching proved beneficial with 13 of the 15 youth hunters harvesting waterfowl during the camp. Not only did the park provide mentorship, they also lent 4 shotguns to youth hunters who did not have their own so they could use them during the waterfowl hunt. Thank you, Tri-State Shooting Park, for your long history of cooperation with the Arizona Game and Fish Department, and especially with your partnership during the 2025 Pintail Slough Youth Waterfowl Camp.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Director, Commissioners, honored guests. Hildy was there from the very beginning, so she was there when we opened the range. The dedication, all that stuff. I just want to take a minute to thank Game and Fish for all the grants that we've gotten from you guys. I mean, we've gotten many grants for all through the 13 years. Tom felt he followed on. He was also there from the beginning. So, and that this is some of our volunteers behind us. They're the guys that do all the work. So, say hi, guys.
Hi. So,
all right. Thank you.
Regional highlights. The floor is yours.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. Welcome again to Mojave County. We're glad to have you here today. And I'm going to give you some updates on what's been going on in Region 3. So again, for the record, my name is Karen Klima. I'm the regional supervisor here in Kingman. Next. Wanted to give you a little overview of our region. We have, I put this in here specifically for Luke. We're about a 3% BLM, about a quarter U.S. Fish and Water, or U.S. Forest Service, and then the rest private, state land, NPS, and tribal. And what's unique about this region is we're very similar to Region 5 in that we have a lot of checkerboarding in our region. And so as you may imagine, this can make some of our management a little difficult. Next. We have three BLM offices, Hassiapa, Kingman, and Lake Havasu. And we also have three forests as well. Our main forest is the Prescott, but we also have the Kaibab and Coconino in Region 3 as well. Next. The theme of this presentation is going to be about the Colorado River. It's about 45 minutes here, half an hour to the west, and it really influences a lot of what we do in Region 3. The Colorado River is known as the lifeline of the Southwest. It's approximately 1,400 miles long and flows through seven U.S. states and into Mexico. The Colorado River drains roughly 1/12 of the land area of the contiguous United States. The lower basin is the basin that we are in, and it covers parts of Nevada, Arizona, California, Utah, and New Mexico. And then the river also supplies water to parts of the states of Baja California and Sonora in northwest Mexico. Next. I'm not going to read through all of the facts that are on this slide, but there are a few I would like to highlight. The Colorado River supplies more than 1 in 10 Americans within the basin states with some, if not all, of their water. Provides irrigation water to more than 5.5 million acres of land. Supports 4,200 megawatts of electrical generating capacity, providing power to millions of people, and also provides habitat for a wide range of species, including threatened and endangered species. Next. I found this graphic from ADWR, and I just thought it was really neat. The Colorado River is more than a third of the state's water. So the CAP pipes water from the Colorado River into Phoenix, and it's just amazing to me that our river supplies that much of Arizona its water. Next. Lake Mead is the largest reservoir in the United States when full. At maximum capacity, it is 112 miles long, 532 feet deep, and the surface area is over 157,000 acres. Lake Mojave is 67 miles long, 138 feet deep, and encompasses over 28,000 acres of water. The Colorado River below Davis Dam is the 42-mile stretch of the Colorado River from Davis Dam to I-40, which is the section in Region 3. Next. We heard Supervisor Martin talk a little bit about striped bass this morning. While Lake Mead and the Colorado River are known for their great striped bass fisheries, Lake Mojave, and more specifically the Willow Beach area, is known as the premier striped bass fishery in Arizona. The state record of 67-pound fish comes from there, and fish over 25 pounds is caught pretty regularly. I see Commissioner Sue getting pretty excited over there. Willow Beach is the place to go. Largemouth bass are common in this reach, and Lake Mojave has a great smallmouth bass fishery with fish in all classes. Rainbow trout are stocked at both Willow Beach and the Colorado River below Davis Dam. Willow Beach National Fish Hatchery stocks 120,000 rainbow trout per year. Most of these are stocked at Willow Beach and in the Colorado River. In addition to these stockings, the Bullhead City Pest Abatement District donates $100,000 annually to the department. And with that, an additional 35,000 trout are purchased with this funding and stocked in the river. Next. Here's our native fish biologist. His name is Austin, and he is showing his affection for a razorback sucker. These were downlisted from endangered to threatened in 2021. While it is often thought that Lake Mojave is the largest wild population of razorback sucker, the largest population is actually located just downstream in the mainstem Colorado River below Davis Dam. The flannelmouth sucker population below Davis Dam is not a historical location. While they are located upstream of Lake Mead, they were not found this low down in the river. They are the result of one stocking of individuals by the department in 1976, and they have persisted in low numbers ever since. With the exception of occasional stockings, bonytail chub no longer exist in this reach, and Colorado pike minnow also no longer exist in the reach. Next. Your slides are moving, right? Because these are frozen up here.
No, they're all frozen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you missed a wonderful picture of Austin kissing a fish. Okay. All right, the Colorado River Nature Center is one of the region's wildlife areas. It is cooperatively managed with Game and Fish, BLM, and the City of Bullhead. In 2023, Game and Fish signed an agreement with the City of Bullhead for a water allocation of 70 acre feet per year to provide water for the newly developed 3-acre pond, which you can see in the center there. Water is fed by groundwater seep from the Colorado River, and so the levels in the pond are dependent on levels in the river. The contract was signed for 50 years and comes from the City of Bullhead's water allocation entitlement from the Colorado River. This pond is stocked with two endangered native fish species, the razorback sucker and desert pupfish. Both species were stocked last year and provide a refugia for the species if needed for population stockings at statewide sites. Next. The region was awarded the department's Conserve and Protect grant in 2024 to create new signs for the Nature Center pond. Region 3 worked with the department's creative services team to develop three new educational signs for our new backwater pond and the two native fish species, desert pupfish and razorback sucker. Next. The next two slides are just two species that rely on the Colorado River. And the first is the greater western mastiff bat. This bat is the largest bat native to North America, and its wingspan can be up to almost 2 feet long. Carly actually set up a bat misnetting event last year, and we caught several of these bats. And let me tell you, it was supreme to be able to see a bat that size. It was just magnificent. But these guys rely on the Colorado River because they're so big, they need a large area in order for them to swoop down and get a drink. So they're frequently seen along the Colorado drinking at night. Next. And then our next species is bighorn sheep. And as you know, in Mojave County and many parts of Arizona, water is a limiting resource. And so the sheep will come down to the river to get a drink, and we see them quite frequently along the edge and right up on the habitat next to the river. Next. Our law enforcement patrols the river and lakes. Last year, we had 2 saturation patrols. There was 24 officers involved, 55 warnings, 18 citations, and 2 OUIs. When I first got here, it was described to me, the Colorado River, as Kevin Costner in The Waterworld. And I'm not sure if you've ever seen that movie, but if you haven't, I recommend it. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic craziness on the waterways, and that is the Colorado River. Common issues include OUIs, breaking the wake zone, insufficient PFDs, and failure to follow navigational rules. I'd like to point out that we've got great cooperation and coordination with Bullhead City, National Park Service, and the Nevada Department of Wildlife. They also all patrol on the rivers and lakes, and we just have a really good partnership with them. Just on the river and just in the Region 3 stretch, we had 28 accidents on the river last year. Thankfully, there were no fatalities, but there were 18 injuries. Next. For outreach, there are 6 life jacket loaner stations. 2 are on Lake Mojave, 1 in Bullhead, and then 3 on Windsor Beach. Windsor Beach is Lake Havasu, which we don't patrol. Region 4 takes care of it, but technically it's in Region 3. Outreach events also include in-person events, and there was 1 held in Bullhead City last year. And the next slide is going to be about a 3-minute clip of what this educational event looks like.
How you guys doing today?
Good. Hi, how are you?
Good afternoon, folks. It's going great. It's going
great. Well, today we're having a safety day here at Catherine's Landing to teach people about life jacket safety.
I'm Jared. I'm with the Arizona Game and Fish Department.
Hi, how are you?
And we're just out here doing public outreach, doing safety awareness.
We're educating people on how to be safe on the water and have a great time.
You do need a throwable device on there, like a Type 4 float cushion or a life ring.
You guys have whistles?
Horn.
You have a horn? That's all you need.
Do you have a throw cushion on your?
I do.
Do you have a fire extinguisher? And okay, perfect. Well, yeah, life jackets that fit for everyone.
I have a fire extinguisher. Look under the driver's compartment.
You know, make sure you got a life jacket that fits every person, a good fire extinguisher, and a Type 4 throwable. That's the square cushion.
Yeah, we got it.
Okay. This is one of the things we do is come out to the lake, talk to boaters.
So I actually have a checklist here for you as well as the Boater's Guide of Arizona.
We've got a little check sheet that we're giving them to pretty much let them know here's what you need to have to be legal out on the water today.
Floatable with about 10 life jackets in there. We have the fire extinguisher.
And if they don't have what they need, we've got things that we're giving out. We've got life jackets, Type 4 throw cushions.
You should always have a throw cushion on your boat. So,
oh, thank you.
Yeah, not a problem.
We can think of a few times where, you know, it came in handy. You know, people needing help.
Also, ski flags and distress signals that we're handing out to them.
Oh, what color do you guys want?
As well as pamphlet information about our boating safety classes so they can learn more about it.
And sir, thank you so much for taking your time to show that. Here's a free life jacket for you, an extra one. Thank you for taking your time. Exactly, yeah, have a great day.
People tend to forget that they need a signaling device, so something like a whistle. If you guys don't have one on you right now,
flag.
Okay, and you do need an audio device. If you want to go ahead and grab one, you guys can just put it on your life vest, and you're good to go. And that's going to save you guys from actually getting a citation. So. Yes, sir.
How about on my boat? I have a horn on my boat.
On the boat, the horn's perfect. That's all you need for that. But for the PWCs, because they're smaller, people tend to forget that they also need the fire extinguishers as well as the signaling devices.
So we want boaters to go out and have a great time, but we want to also have them be safe.
Just the checklist of safe boating in Arizona, making sure we had everything on the recommended list, which we do.
Thanks, guys. You're doing a good job. Appreciate it.
Wearing a life jacket is the number one thing that you can do to prevent a fatality on the water. We had 9 fatalities here in Arizona last year, and 80% of those people were not wearing life jackets.
We don't have life jackets.
Okay, well, then absolutely, we're going to hook you up with that because that is required by law.
We had a gentleman earlier today that had just bought a boat and pulled up here to the Make Ready area. And we found out that he didn't have any safety equipment on his boat as he was getting ready to launch. They didn't have any life jackets or a throw cushion or a fire extinguisher. So we gave the gentleman everything he needed.
Well, that was nice. I couldn't believe that. You did pull up there and we didn't know what we were doing. So it was perfect.
That's why we're out here to promote safety and fun on the water.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Lake Mojave. Thank you guys for being out here and the wonderful tent you have set up there. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, sir.
Okay, if that didn't come through on your, I'm glad to send you the link for it if you'd like to watch it. Do you have any questions for me?
No. Seeing none, no.
No.
Thank you.
No, you? I'm sorry. I apologize.
I would love to thank you for all the time and keeping all of our people safe when on the water, on the ground, whatever it is. Your work is so much appreciated, not only by this commissioner, but I know everybody in Mojave County and everyone that you touch. So thanks for your hard work, the time you put into it, your background, everything, and it shows. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Supervisor Clymer. Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, we'll open up the agenda. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Commission. We will be operating off the agenda dated May 7, 2025. For the benefit of the public, agendas are available and located on the table by the door. If a member of the public wishes to speak to the Commission on an agenda item, please fill out a blue slip, also available on the table. Give the blue slip to staff, and we will ensure that you are recognized on the appropriate agenda item. If you would like to present the Commission with materials as part of your presentation, please place the materials in the inbox on the table by the door, and we'll make sure that they are distributed. We are webcasting this meeting. However, the webcast is not interactive. The department accommodates comments and discussion from attendees in person and at regional offices via video conference and electronic blue slips. Getting complex. Everybody's leaving while I'm reading. If you want to address the Commission on something that is not on the agenda, we have a call to the public notice for that purpose. You can sign up for the call to the public by filling out a blue slip. The chair will recognize you, and at that time you may address the Commission. In accordance with the open meeting law, the Commission is not able to discuss or take any action on a topic brought up in a call to the public because it was not noticed on the public agenda, but the Commission may refer it to a future meeting or ask the department to respond to the comments or meet with you to address the issue. With that, Mr. Chairman, we'll move on to agenda item one, which is call to the public.
Thank you, Mr. Director. My understanding is that we have two blue slips here. One wants to speak during the agenda item number three. Do we have any from any of the
Mr. Chairman, we do have some blue cards in the regions, primarily region 4 and 6, with one individual that looks like they want to speak during call to the public. The rest would be item 3 and 1 for item 16.
Okay, then what we'll do is we'll start with those that are not with the call to the public. I believe it's Mr. Works. Kenny Works, are you here? Come on down, Mr. Works. Please state your name, sir, and once you start speaking, you have 3 minutes.
Kenny Works. I reside in Yucca. I came to this area in 2001 from northeastern California. Over the years, I've noticed that over hearing on the radio, there would be occasional calls of the wild hogs in the Topok area, but I've never heard any of the outcome of any of these procedures, how they're carried out, and I think that's something we need, some communication in that area, so I'd appreciate it. In Yucca, they don't believe in newspapers in Yucca, so for me to get a newspaper, it's a 36-mile round trip to Lake Havasu intersection at 95 and I-40 for the newspaper. It's the closest one available. But if we could get more information on what happens to these cold animals and how all of this business is carried out, it would be appreciated. And if we could at least get the newspapers involved in being concerned about this type of activity, I would really appreciate it. And those of us in Yucca would appreciate it as well. We have wildlife issues in Yucca. We have a 300 square mile area of a subdivision out there south of town, and we maintain our own roads out there, and we have a Property Owners Association for that purpose. But more communications in that area would certainly be appreciated. And I do appreciate your showing up here in Kingman. I didn't know about it till Monday. Don Martin announced Monday at the supervisor meeting that you were going to be here. So I made it a point to be here and have a chance to speak to you. And I do appreciate your being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Works. We appreciate your words and thank you for coming. Mr. Thompson, do we have anybody for the simple call to the public?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so in Region 4.
Why don't we go to Region 4 then, please?
Good morning, Chairman Hernandez, members of the commission. I have here in Region 4, Doug Beach.
Good morning. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Why don't you tell us who we have? I recognize that gentleman.
Good morning, Chairman Hernandez, members of the commission. We have Doug Beach from the Yuma Rodman Club.
Mr. Beach, good, it's good to see you again.
Mr. Chairman, Director, members of the commission. My name's Douglas Beach. I'm president of the Yuma Valley Rod and Gun Club. And I'm here to talk more for myself and my volunteer work about the PVC system. I would wait for the agenda, but I got a truck and a trailer sitting out back waiting to haul some more water. The information, let me give you a little background. I've been checking 41 waters for roughly 8 years. 17 of those waters, half of them have a dual system, a PVC system and an apron system. Yesterday, we had some rain Tuesday. Yesterday, I ran out to check one of the apron systems with the hope of collecting, it had collected water. And my results are the PVC system was completely full. 26 and a half inches in the pipe, meaning it overflowed. The ring tank system that's connected to the apron had 11 inches of water in it. And out of the 17 systems that I check regularly, half of them have the dual system. And this, my results from yesterday are typically what happens. The PVC system fills up way before the apron system because it catches water way upstream someplace. In all the PVC systems that I have assisted in building, we've repaired one in the last 20 years, to my knowledge. I would appreciate if the PVC system was left in place. The PVC system works in Yuma, or the Yuma region. The Yuma Valley Rod and Gun Club is adamant about installing these. If the PVC system goes away, I'd hate to think the feedback I'd get from members and the people that are adamant about installing them. We don't have the technology to install the apron system. And that being said, I'd like to add something to the director. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you in January, and good things are happening thanks to our conversations. That's all I have. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Beach, thank you so much. We always appreciate hearing from you, and more importantly, the work you and your folks do out there. So thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, Mr. Director, I think we're going to take a short break while we fix the audio and video feed. Apparently, it is within the building, and they're going to have to set up a screen for us. So, all right, so we'll recess for probably a maximum of 10 minutes, but we might get done quicker than that. Thank you. We're going to go back in session, and before I turn it back to the director, I want to, on behalf of the commission, thank our AV folks. We know the hoops you guys jump through before this meeting starts, and then we're here in the middle of it, and you drop everything and reinvent the wheel, and it does not go unnoticed by any of us. So thank you all. We really appreciate what you do all the time, but certainly today. I also want to thank the WMs back there for jumping up and helping us get that stuff done. So thank you. Mr. Director, are we still on call to the public?
Mr. Chairman, we do not have any other call to the publics that I'm aware of.
Very well, Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, we'll move on to item two, which is a consent agenda. We have one item on the consent agenda, and that's approve the fiscal year 2027 proposed budget and fiscal year 2026 amendments. The presenter would be Jen Alsbaugh, Business and Finance Branch Chief.
And do I have a motion with regard to that or any questions?
Make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
I have a motion by Commissioner Guggenhauer, a second by Commissioner Buchanan to approve the consent agenda. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, she missed her chance to seize the record, but that's okay. item number three is approved notice of termination of rulemaking for Article 2, licenses, permits, stamps, tag. Presenter is Clay Crowder, Assistant Director, Wildlife Management Division.
Director Crowder, Assistant Director Crowder, do you want to speak before the blue slips are read, or do you want to speak after them?
Mr. Chairman, I've never had that opportunity to have a thought on it, so it's really your determination. I'm happy to get into this.
Why don't we do the blue slips first, yes, if you don't mind? And I'll start with Mr. Rimza. Brian. Good morning. Please give us your name, and you've got 3 minutes. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the Commission. My name is Brian Rimza. I'm here on behalf of Bow Hunting and Arizona Rec Book Committee, as well as working with Pope and Young on some of these recommendations that were presented to you, the Commission. 6 months ago, the Department recommended to repeal the current crossbow permit. That recommendation wasn't eliminating crossbows. That recommendation was repealing the current crossbow permit and allowing those individuals with CHAMP permits who have permanent physical disabilities who need crossbows to use crossbows. There's misinformation out there that we're trying to get rid of crossbows altogether for people to be used during archery hunts. That is not true. But that initial recommendation came after public comment, observed abuse by your WMs. When I first presented this to the commission in Payson last year, several of your WMs came up to me and approached me and thanked me for bringing this topic up to you guys. So if you want more facts behind the stories, ask the people in the field, your employees who are stuck dealing with this. Secondly, we evaluated 2 years of harvest data that showed that 10% of archers were using crossbows, and they were harvesting up to 15 to 25% of the deer in certain units. And then there was a crossbow committee that was created that contained a robust group of individuals from the public and the department. And the recommendation was presented to you because the only way to get rid of the abused permits is to start from scratch. So no one's saying, again, to get rid of it completely. So what changed? Here, Mr. Crowder's going to present to you basically to reopen public comment and reopen and reevaluate it. And it says because of public comment. I spent 3 hours yesterday going through 600 public comments. 52% of those supported exactly what was presented to you 6 months ago. Another 10 to 15% of those supported some form of change, but they had their own ideas. And then 30 to 35%, and my numbers are close, but they may not be perfect, didn't want anything done. We can't do anything. The conversation that comes up is about opportunity. This is not just about opportunity for archers. We're losing Unit 1 and 27. Even a crossbow hunter is not going to be able to hunt Unit 1 and 27 with a crossbow now because of the harvest rates being exceeded. Additionally, we have to take action. If we push this down the road, it's going to be another 12 to 18 months before something is done. What I would ask the commission to do is approve what was proposed 6 months ago and then direct the department to come up with a more restrictive crossbow permit, if that's what you want to do, before January 1st. This addresses both sides of the argument. Not my argument that that we need to limit it, as well as those individuals who want to keep it and have it. So there is a solution there that doesn't kick the can down the road for another 12 months. How many more hunts are we going to lose in that time frame because we're not addressing a problem that was created by the commission in 2015? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Remsen. We always appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we have two individuals in Region 6 that wish to also speak on this item.
Thank you. Region 6.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Commissioners, can you hear me?
Violet,
she's going to talk for you.
Go ahead.
Hello, Commissioners. My name is Violet Richardson. I am 9 years old and go to Vista Del Sur Accelerated Academy, where I'm in third grade. I am proud to say that I'm a fourth generation Arizona bow hunter. I have been working very hard to be able to pull a 30-pound bow so that I can hunt deer and javelina when I turn 10 years old. Archery deer hunting is one of my family's favorite hunts because it is challenging and one of the only guaranteed chances to hunt every year with over-the-counter tags. I'm excited to go on my first bow hunt with my great-grandpa, grandma, papa, and of course my mom and dad. I want to ask you to please stop allowing people to get crossbow permits who do not have real disabilities, because if not, there will be any left over for the country archery hunts for me, my brother George, and my sister Stephanie and Dolly. I would still like there to be special crossbow permits for during archery hunts if somebody has a special need or disability, like my baby sister. My baby sister was born with a major heart problem and had to have surgery when she was 9 days old. She has a very rare genetic syndrome that might prevent her from shooting a bow, but the doctors also weren't sure she was going to walk, and she's already running around all over the place, so she is certainly going to try to pull a bow. I know there are people who want to bow hunt but truly can't. I am glad that there is a special program for them. I do not think it is fair that people are cheating to get these new special permits because they are afraid to work hard and try something new. Archery is hard, but very fun. My little brother and I practice at our house almost every night with our dad, and we are getting very good. Thanks so much for protecting hunting opportunities for me and all other boys and girls in Arizona who want to hunt like all of you have gotten to do.
Thank you very much. That was very well done. What's your name again?
Violet.
Violet? Well, thank you, Violet. We appreciate you coming in.
Welcome.
Very well done.
She wrote that all by herself. I've been dreaming of the day that I get to take her for about a decade, and here it is. She turns 10 in November. Good morning, Commissioners. I want to encourage you all to do the right thing regarding crossbows. I understand that people in positions of leadership, especially in the public sector like yourselves, are under pressure and scrutiny around decisions that could be viewed as non-inclusive. The current process for obtaining a crossbow permit is massively abused, though, and you know it. I know you know it. By repealing this, you're not excluding people with disabilities, but rather you're protecting them, because the people that actually have champ permits will still have access to this special permit. I put this just a few notches below like stolen valor, where people are going and getting access to these permits so that they can use a crossbow. You have the data that shows the massive influx of crossbow permits. You have the data that shows that they're more effective than a traditional archery setup. And you have the power to stop this abuse today and start fresh, as Mr. Rinda said. I have been very unapologetic with my support of the crossbow repeal because I want to preserve archery for young children like that. I've got four of them, three coming up behind Violet. The two most popular comments I get back when people want to argue with me about this, and I don't mean to argue, have great discussion. Number one, well, if this is an archery, then neither is a compound. I actually understand that. I think in the Western U.S., there's a lot of states that are walking back the definition of a muzzleloader because the advancements in technology have far exceeded the original intent. So I get that. But that's not what this argument's about. This rule that we're supposed to hopefully be voting on today
is actually about fixing a broken system. It's not about what is and isn't archery. You've already defined that. And based on the definition that the Arizona Game and Fish Department has, a crossbow does not meet that. But we do have a permit that allows someone to bring something that is a method of take, not defined as archery, across those said boundaries. So this is repeal is about fixing a broken system. The second biggest argument I get is, well, yes, I can pull 40 pounds, but that's not ethical. Commissioners, I want to ask you, does anyone know the name of the man who was the first person to harvest the Arizona Big Ten with a bow and arrow? The reason no one knows that name of him is because it was a her. My mother was the first person to harvest the Arizona Big Ten with a bow and arrow, and she did it with a 42-pound bow. And in the cross her hunting career, she's harvested 14 bull elk with a bow and arrow set at 42 pounds. Last week, a retailer told me he had three young men come in, young strapping men, that bought brand new bows because they heard the crossbow permits are going away. They all walked out shooting 70-pound limbs. I can't. That is one of the most dangerous phrases a human being can say and utter out of their lips. And when people, you all know that people that are saying, I can't pull a 40-pound bow, they never even tried in the first place. And they're abusing the system. So please, repeal this. Keep it for folks with champ permits. And let's start fresh and fix the process. Thank you so much for all you guys do.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time. And I believe that is the end of the folks there at the region. Based upon that, Assistant Director Crowder.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just going to get started and roll right into this. A little bit of background related to why we're here. So under Article 2, and specifically termination rulemaking, so we're on the same page of where we're at. Next slide, please. Little refresher on who's involved. Number of team members across the department. For those, I know the commission's aware of this. I don't think we've had the opportunity yet to thank and recognize Celeste Cook in her retirement. She was a big support for the department and the rule and rulemaking process. And she retired. Christopher Dean's taken her place and as a new member of our team. So again, just some folks from across the department involved in this. Next slide, please. Just so we're all on the same page in terms of what's defined in Article 2, it's license, permit, stamps, and tags. And just want to focus on the area within the what we were looking at are those identified in bold, which include the Pioneer license, complimentary and reduced free disabled veterans, reduced fee for Purple Heart medical license, the HIP stamp, waterfowl migratory bird, high achievement scout license. Next slide, please. Again, the reason these are bolded is this was what was part of the initial view and the recommendation the commission approved back in December. Guide license, lifetime license, benefactor, and crossbow permit. So I'm going to run through these, next slide, please, fairly quickly, but just a refresher of what that included. A lot of what the department focused on was clarifying either terms or providing some updates in terms of what was there, such as if a disabled veteran's license, they have lifetime benefits, even if the holder moves out of state. Touch on briefly, just because it's important for the department to keep the commission updated on what that means for the HIP, which is the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then with at least for the waterfowl and migratory bird stamp piece, updating some of the language there, and then again, the high achievement scout license. Next slide, please. One of the clarifications on the guide license was amending some language and including some additional language for revoked guides from guiding via subcontracted. Lifetime license benefactor is clarification on documents. And the next piece was that champ holders would be able to use a pre-charged pneumatic weapon discharging arrow and bolt in archery only hunts. Next slide, please. And then we get into the crossbow permit. Next slide, please. History. And just, again, so we're all on the same page. In 1996, the department initiated the permanent crossbow permit. In 2001, only the doctor of medicine or osteopathy were able to perform the certification for those applications. 2015, the departments initiated the temporary crossbow permit, and this was in response to public comment. The qualifications for the permanent were too strict, and essentially what ended up occurring is relaxed the requirements for healthcare professionals, so there was no longer just two professionals that could perform, review the applications for those. And then with that, the doctors were able to decide the valid time frame for temporary permits. Fast forward to 2019, the department initiated so that in order to have clarification consistently, temporary permits were only valid for 1 year after medical certification. Next slide, please. And then it again brings us to why we're focused on the crossbow permit, and some of the comments you've heard this morning were related to public concerns that there is abuse in permanent crossbow permits within Article 2 and 3 hunt guidelines review periods. Again, keep in mind the department through the hunt guideline process was finalized in 2023, and even during that time, the department received comments on suggested abuse and an interest in those things. The focus revolved around archery over the counter, deer hunting opportunities, and there were similar ideas that were presented regarding the draw hunts, which were archery elk, deer, and pronghorn. Some of that includes a mandatory harvest reporting for over-the-counter deer, which suggested 10% of archery hunters use compounds, but harvest up to 30% of deer reported. Again, this was based on the preliminary data the department was looking at, because after the commission's, how we started moving through the archery over-the-counter, there's mandatory harvest reporting for archery over-the-counter, right? And then finally, although there's other variables that come into play with regards to hunting and hunt days, based on hunter questionnaire and harvest, crossbow hunters have less days of field in comparison to archery hunters. Next slide, please. The other aspect to this, the department started looking at the biological components and if there's effects, and noted that in some archery only, so over-the-counter archery only, targeting a mule deer, and this included in any antler deer units. Within those, crossbow harvest exceeded 10%. And again, over target harvest threshold in a number of those where we had some units that were closing within the first weekend, just because the harvest thresholds have been met. Some of the social feedback the department received is concerns of units closing too quickly, concentration of hunt pressure into remaining archery-only units, meaning that as hunts or units close, that would move hunters into other units and have a similar concerns with those units then closing as well because the harvest thresholds have been met. Concerns that there was limiting opportunity for archery hunters, and then ultimately concerns that, again, these are from the public, that may move over-the-counter archery opportunities into draw faster. As an example, during the last hunt recommendations cycle, the commission approved at least two units, unit 127, that were moved from over-the-counter opportunity to draw for those two. Next slide, please. Flashback to where the department was in December of 24. And at the time, the department's recommendation was related to Article 2, was in order to receive public comment, we had to have a very narrow piece of the language. And so it was invalidate all existing crossbow permits, both permanent and temporary, such that no future issue of permits would occur. And just some of the details there, crossbows were still eligible for hand, muzzle, general hunts, champ. And then part of the department's rationale was improvements in crossbow technology advanced to a point the crossbow is no longer comparable to standard archery equipment and cannot be considered a reasonable accommodation in archery-only hunts. So because of the scope of what the department was anticipating receiving comments on, specifically the repeal of the crossbow permit, the comment period was 90 days, which started on January 2nd, ended on April 3rd. Next slide, please. Just walk you briefly through, I'm not going to read through each of these, give you a general idea. Quite a few comments. There's A number in favor, a number opposed. There was support of regulation instead of repeal. And then, of course, touching on additional archery restrictions, or if I recall correctly from comments, it was move all OTC to draw, and that would be part of it. Some public comments asked questions or voiced concerns, but it was difficult for the department to extract anything in terms of whether they provided a position on the repeal. And then just as a summary, like we do for all rule review, there was 40 duplicate comments, 11 early and 8 late. Next slide, please. I'm just gonna walk through again what some of the suggestions from the public comments occurred. Establishing strict eligibility or equipment requirements, restrict doctor types that certify, limit crossbow permits to pioneer license holders, senior citizens, or 100% disabled vets. I know the commission's familiar with what it is for a pioneer license. Going from my memory, I think it's anybody over the age of 70 and has been a resident for 25 years consecutively. And so that was some of the comments that we received. Limit number of crossbow permits issued, which would, and then also issue these through a draw. Repeal and sunset current permanent crossbow permit holders. Repeal the temporary crossbow permit, but retain the permanent crossbow permit. I say permit a lot. Implement an education campaign focused on ethical hunting practices, safety, and conservation. So that was a summary of all the comments that we received. And essentially, just to focus briefly now on what this means in terms of process related to a rule, right? The department sought permission to move forward with rule review. We were performing that. What we came to the commission in December was a number of things I read through that included the language tied to guide licenses, tied to benefactors, et cetera, as well as the piece that would repeal the use of crossbow permits. And based on public comment and what we were looking at, it seemed as if there were still some stones that hadn't been turned over. Good feedback from the public. It's a public process, helping to inform the department. We did have a focus group as the department was moving along to ensure that we thought we captured everything, but there were still some things that the department had not fully identified or benchmarked either with Western states or states that may offer crossbow permit and hunting opportunities. And so from a rule process standpoint, there's only so many pathways. In order to move forward, we wouldn't have all the information the department needed to provide a recommendation to the commission, which was focused on the repeal of the crossbow permit. Secondly, it would be looking at, is there supplemental language that would be part of that process for rule? And finally, termination. And that brings us here today. Because we still have some stones that we need to turn over with regards to ideas that came in from the public, some additional benchmarking that the department needs to do, that's why the department will have a recommendation to terminate rule such that the department can spend some time doing further evaluation related to specifically the crossbow permit. I do think it's important to point out to the commission, because I didn't say it earlier, all the comments the department received were on the crossbow permit. We did not receive any other comments on any other aspect of Article 2 and the rules identified, clarifications, etc. And so from a rule standpoint, in order to have more time, that's why we'd be terminating it. Next slide, please. Just for consideration for the commission, because initially part of the recommendation that came forward is to have a snapshot, next slide, please, of timelines under the previous path. It was the rule would go into effect of January of 2026. Because the department will be moving forward with the recommendation to terminate, spend some time evaluating, and then return to the commission with our plan is next month, which would to seek permission to enter into a rule-making process, which would then open, from a rule process standpoint, open it up for public comment on other aspects the department has identified, which would include a 30-day comment period. The department would return to the commission in the fall with not only just public comments, but also the additional work that we've done turning over the stones. And as an example, here's what that would look like. So if the commission approved notice of rulemaking termination, the department would come back to the commission next month with a notice of rulemaking docket, which is again seeking permission to re-enter rulemaking on additional aspects of Article 2, focused specifically on the crossbow permit side, anticipating a public comment period from June through July. We would bring the back to the commission in September. Part of the rulemaking process again is coordination with GRIC, and then anticipating that as soon as July of 26 or at a later time, what I think is really important is this is some speculation on our part, because in order to understand what rules would be in place, there's going to be aspects that need to be steps that were taken in order for implementation based on rule, and doing it in a time frame consideration of what those actions would be, whether for those to become compliant, whatever the rule would be. I think it's important to also point out that right now Article 2 rule is in effect. There's no change, nothing's there other than what the department's looking at for these pieces. So under previous Article 2 rule, including the crossbow permit, that's still in effect. None of that would change up until the point the commission would approve final rulemaking. Unless there's any questions, I have a recommendation.
Comment, but I'll wait for
his recommendation. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question.
Commissioner Guggenhauer.
Thank you, Clay. Appreciate the information. So moving out to July, I know that GRIC has certain time frames to get different rules approved, and then they allow a grace period. And I thought we were up against the stops. Does this violate that, or are we still within their window?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Guggenhauer, great question. And that's still part of it. It won't violate the time, because based on this, it would be terminating and then reinitiating, which still falls within what the department sought for approval from the governor's office with respect to rulemaking. So there's no violation, because we're stopping it. Had we tried to continue outside of that, it would have likely impacted the timeline that was we had.
Thank you, sir. So just an additional comment. I think that's a great move. That gives us some time. We've said before that we want to make sure we do this right and not necessarily do it fast. So I think with this new schedule and getting that flexibility to stop the clock, if you will, while we do this is brilliant. So thank you for doing that. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Guggenhauer. I have a question for you, Assistant Director. The date you have in that next steps, the commission considers approves notice of final rulemaking September 5th. That's what we would be, so we're talking about taking it from today to September 5th. Is that basically what we're doing? I mean, I know there's things in between, but that's what we're talking about, is a 4-month difference.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So again, if the department came back in June, it would be to seek approval in order to enter into that. That would allow public comment, which would include those pieces. So I guess short of it, the next decision that commission could be making is as early as September, and that would be a decision based on Article 2, not authorization to reinitiate in Article 2. That would be the first decision in order to have received public comment, but a decision from the commission with respect to what's identified in Article 2, specifically crossbow permit, would be as early as September, but we still would have some time in terms of timeline. So I wanted to, that would be the earliest. It could fall later. Keep in mind there's some meetings that don't occur in the fall, but that would be the earliest the department would return.
And is it your belief, sir, that, I'm sorry, I'm not in a courtroom. Is it your belief that you, that the department can get that done between now and, in September, with regard to the comment period, and then as you were saying, I think you're exactly right, talking about turning over the rest of the stones that need to be looked at. But can we deal with that potential unintended consequences, things of that nature, by September?
Mr. Chairman, so the team's been working very steadily and hard.
That's true.
And so my thoughts are, in conversation with Larissa, team lead, as well as the team, that is possible. I think the one part of unintended consequences, that would be the important part that we'd still need to flesh out based on, again, not just public comment, but what does that mean for implementation? What does that mean for anything that would be identified under what the commission would approve the department to move forward on for public comment, rulemaking, et cetera. So in long-winded way of saying this, I apologize. Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Mr. Kerr.
Assistant Director Crowder, thanks for all your work on this. I know it hasn't been easy. But by terminating the rulemaking, the current system, would the status quo would remain? Nothing would change in the meantime. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Kerr, that's correct. So what's in rule right now is how not only the department, but our users would be operating under.
Thank you.
Any other questions? But that'll be after. So do you have a recommendation for us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Next slide, please. The department recommends that the commission vote to approve the notice of termination of rulemaking for Article 2, licenses, permits, stamps, and tags.
Before we move forward on that, do I have any comments, Commissioner Buchanan?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Assistant Director Crowder, for your presentation and all your hard work, as well as the members of the department and members of the public who have participated in this. So I've got some, first of all, I don't plan to support your recommendation. I'll just say that up front, and I want to lay out my rationale for why. First comment is I'm good with all the other changes that we recommended on Article 2. High achievement scout license, the change in the guide licenses, et cetera. And I think that the fundamental conflict, as you laid out for us, really has to do with crossbows. My own philosophy follows what our own department says and what the Pope and Young Club says, which is that crossbows are not an archery weapon and they don't belong in an archery season. Now, I believe that our commission had a good intent a number of years ago when they started this process, and even 10 years ago when they started the temporary crossbow permit, which, by the way, now has been good. Any temporary injuries which would cause one to ask to use a crossbow could easily be accounted for using the point guard system, which has since evolved and should negate any temporary permits. But I think our intent was right. Years ago, we were trying to accommodate people who had injuries and wanted to be able to continue to hunt during an archery-only season, a primitive weapon season. But several factors have combined to change that situation. First of all, we have evolution in technology, and we heard a lot of this stuff today. We have an evolution in technology of the crossbow themselves. They've become more lethal, accurate, long-range, easier to operate. We have magnified scopes, which, again, extend the range or potential range of these weapons, and the sheer growth in numbers of the people holding permits in our state. And then, more importantly, we have numerous observations of abuse of the system. And I've talked about them in the past, observations, comments from wildlife managers, from archery shop owners. We don't have data about that. That's a problem. And frankly, we're not going to get it in the next 3 months. I don't think we're going to get actual data that tells us what's the extent of the problem. We have a lot of anecdotal observations about abuse. But the issue of all these different things is they're combining to start having a biological impact. They certainly have a social impact. We just heard about it from a number of archery hunters who feel like the system is being abused. And I know that this is not a vote. We don't hold an election here on what we decide. Ultimately, we're going to decide to do what we believe is right. But there's a lot of concern and a lot of support for repealing our current system. So what do we do about it? You know, we really have a basic choice here with respect to the crossbow part of Article 2. We can either maintain the current system and accept that it's good enough and kick the can down the road and maybe try to fix some of the ancillary things, or we can start over. Now, my belief is that we should start over. I've listened to a number of people who offered ideas about limiting technology on the bows or limiting take by crossbow hunters, you know, which would obviously increase the administrative burden on the department, different ways to do that. But most of those ideas deal with the consequences. They don't deal with the core problem itself. The core problem is the abuse of the system that we had with a pure heart tried to enact a number of years ago. We already have a system to allow people that are disabled to use a crossbow during an archery only season, and that's called CHAMP. And if we decided that we wanted to make more exceptions for other people who don't qualify for a CHAMP permit, but to hunt with a crossbow during an archery only season, we could consider some of those as long as they deal with the core problem, which is, again, the abuse. We'd have to make it much stricter, and anything less than that's just putting a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound. All we're doing is dressing it up and kicking the can down the road. I think that the only way to actually fix a problem is start again from zero rather than trying to dress up something that is fundamentally broken. So for all of those reasons, I support continuing rulemaking on Article 2 and to include all aspects of it.
Thank you, Commissioner Buchanan.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Guggenhauer.
If I could just make a few comments. Thank you, Commissioner, for those comments. They're great. Where I get into issues with some of these is it all sounds good on the surface. When we ask the question, where's the data that supports that? How do we know that? That's where it gets weak. Today, you can't hunt with a crossbow during archery season unless you have that permit to go do that. So to say that it's part of the hunt, it's not. It's with that disability, with that temporary limitation is what it's called in the rule. But what Assistant Director Crowder is saying is there are lots of areas where we just don't have that data, and I agree with Commissioner Buchanan that in September we probably still won't have all the answers to that. But hopefully between now and then, we'll get some more data to better understand the decision that we're making at that time. So I get all the arguments. Trust me, I've talked to a lot of you, read the comments just as well as everybody else. But data is king. Data is knowledge. And I'd rather get this right than us sit here 3 or 4 years from now, just like we're reading the history that this has been that got us to where we are today. We got to get this right, and we need data to be able to get to that point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other comments? Seeing none, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd make a motion to approve the recommendation as presented.
I have a motion by Commissioner Guggenhauer. Do I have a second? I'll second that motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Nay.
Nay.
Motion passes 3-2. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, item 4 is approve the notice of proposed rulemaking, notice of rulemaking docket opening, and an economic impact statement amending rules within Article 4, live wildlife. The presenter is Martin Grenia, Wildlife Law Enforcement Supervisor.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission.
Can you hear me now? Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. For the record, I'm Martin Grania, law enforcement program supervisor out of Tucson, Region 5. And thank you for the opportunity to present our notice of proposed rulemaking package to you today for Article 4 Live Wildlife. I'm the Article 4 team lead. Next slide, please. Just a general overview for Article 4. They're the rules that establish the regulations that apply to the taking, handling, and possession of live wildlife, and the special licenses and licensing requirements associated with these activities. Next slide, please. So Article 4 team members, we have Tony Giles as our sponsor. We have myself as a team lead. We have Linda Pollock as our assistant AG. Kelly Tharp, Chad Rupke, Kurt Gill, Darren Julian, and Christopher Dean, who took over for Celeste Cook. And just want to make sure we acknowledge all those folks. We also had two team members who've been at this for 3 years that left the department, and that was Chris Crippen and Heather Gilhog. We also had two sub-teams and a lot of other subject matter experts that know who they are and just want to make sure that they got credit for all the help that they did for us. Next slide, please. So this is our current timeline. We're here today for the notice of proposed rulemaking, and then we will open for public comment period in June and July. Then we will come back to the commission in September for the final rulemaking. Then we will go to GIRC in October and November. And then hopefully everything's done by then. We'll be approved with an effective date in January of 2026. Next slide, please. So our rule changes are intended to maintain consistency between rules, clarify rule language, and reduce regulatory burden on the public, protect native wildlife populations, attempt to align state and federal regulations, and provide for public safety. Next slide, please. So jumping right into it, with all of these different rules here, we're simply going to clarify that a license holder's annual report is due by January 31st, but may be submitted as soon as January 1st. There's some different language in some of these, and we're just making sure that they're all consistent. Next slide, please. So with 402, our live wildlife unlawful acts, 403, escape to release live wildlife, we're adding the verbiage require the surrender of to create consistency among rules. It's already in 409, 417, and 423. We will also be adding it to 407, which you'll see here shortly. And the term require the surrender of clarifies the department's authority to require a person to surrender the wildlife when needed to protect public health and safety, or the protection of wildlife. Next slide, please. 406 is our restricted live wildlife. Here we're adding specific taxa for aquatic wildlife to further clarify the species that are often misidentified in the pet trade or pose a threat to native and sport fish populations. There was a recent change to the taxonomic nomenclature for some of these aquatic species, so we're just going in and putting those into rule. The second part is to clarify a restriction for northern bobwhite quail and that they are restricted statewide and not just limited to units 36 A, B, and C. We're just going to remove the reference to those three units. Next slide, please. So 407 is our exemptions from special license requirements. Here we're going to clarify that all desert tortoises lawfully possessed prior to April 28, 1989 are the property of the possessor. We're also going to clarify that all desert tortoises and their progeny possessed on or after that date are the property of the state. Next, we're going to clarify a resident may lawfully possess a desert tortoise by adopting it through a department authorized adoption program or by receiving a lawfully possessed desert tortoise as a gift. Next one, these are new. This is going to be possession limits are going to be one per person, per household, not to exceed four per household. All desert tortoises in excess of possession limits shall be surrendered to the department. And there's that language you see again here in 407. The last one would be to require male and female desert tortoises to be kept separated and housed in separate enclosures to help do the best that we can to prevent propagation. Next slide, please. So with 409 are general provisions and penalties, 412 is our special license fees. Here we're going to clarify that initial license fee is only required when there's a change to the license facility location or license holder, not a change to the species on the license. Next slide, please. So 413, this is our private game farm license. And this rule authorizes a person to commercially farm and sell captive pen-reared game birds. Subsections B and C were confusing to us and also to the public, so we combined them both. And now it's going to state that private game farm captive pen-reared game birds may only be killed or slaughtered by the private game farm license holder. And this is not to be confused with 414. 414 covers the different licenses for hunting those captive pen-reared game birds. And the last one here, we're going to require the license holder to maintain records for a period of 5 years, and that's to increase consistency and reflect agency record retention requirements. Next slide, please. 418 is our scientific activity license. Here we're going to clarify that a scientific activity license allows a person to photograph and or video record wildlife for non-commercial purposes when specified on the license. And here we're just adding the video record part. Next slide, please. So 421 is our wildlife service license. Here we're going to clarify the nuisance wildlife and specifically rodent species. A person who possesses a license issued by the Arizona Department of Agriculture Pest Management Division, these are our pest management companies, may remove without having to obtain a wildlife service license. And so these are going to be rodents except for beaver, porcupine, and tree squirrels. So just simplified that, made it easy for them to understand that. And then the last part to this is we're just adding the verbiage that a wildlife service license holder shall inspect traps daily, and this will mirror the current language that's in our trapping regulations. Next slide, please. So 422, this is our sport falconry license. We got quite a few here. This is one of the largest rules that we had to review. And so we'll start with combining two subsections. That's going to be EE and J to clarify health certificate requirements. One section talked about residents and the other was talking about non-residents. We just put them together so you didn't have to look for that in separate sections. Second one here is removing the reference to 409I to make the rule more concise. Last rulemaking did away with captivity standards under 428 for sport falconry, and that reference is still there, so we're just going to remove that. The next one, we're removing the reference to non-permit tags because all raptor tags are now using a computer draw system. And then the last one for this one, we're going to remove the reference to bald eagle to clarify bald eagles are not allowed to use for sport falconry. Next slide, please. More on sport falconry. Here we're going to establish a consistent time frame for the period of time an applicant must wait before retaking an exam. Did some benchmarking, did a lot of coordination with our license administrators, and this is what we agreed with. So an applicant who fails the examination on their first attempt may retake the examination no earlier than 15 days from the date of the failed examination. After that, if they fail again, they would have to wait 30 days to take it a third time. And there is an error on this slide. It talks about a third and fourth attempt, but they only get three chances. So just for the record, want to note that. And speaking of that, the next one is each examination may only be taken a maximum of three times during calendar year. And the last one, the examination shall not be returned to the applicant at any time. Next slide, please. So for 423, this is our wildlife rehabilitation license. This is going to be the exact same slide that I just read. And for the record, there is an error on that one as well. Next slide, please. So 430, this is our importation, handling, and possession of cervids. This would require persons possessing a cervid to maintain, make available all records pertaining to the origin, disposition of cervids for a period of 5 years after the disposition or death of the animal. This is just record retention stuff. And next slide, please. And that is our package. Any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman, if I could. Officer Garina, thank you for the call. Thank you for the great information. You as well, Kelly. This team put a lot of work into this effort. They reach out to a lot of agencies that kind of have licenses and manage wildlife and handle wildlife. And trust me, there are a lot of different requirements, a lot of different contact. I speak of the Sport Falconry group that always is engaged in this process, and we appreciate those there. But I wanted to thank this team because this is one of our more difficult ones to put together and to coordinate all the people that are engaged in this. So great conversation. Appreciate the information, and I look to support this. Thank you.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Very good. You have a recommendation for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I do have a recommendation for you. The Department recommends that the Commission vote to approve the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, Notice of Rulemaking Docket Opening, and Economic Impact Statement Amending Rules within Article 4, Live Wildlife.
So moved.
I have a motion by Commissioner Buchanan.
Second.
I have a second by Vice Chairman Sue. Any other comment or questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. That, Mr. Chairman, that brings us to our time certain, which is item 6, hearings on license revocations for violations of game and fish codes and civil assessments for the illegal taking and or possession of wildlife. The presenter is Dean Elms, Law Enforcement Branch Chief.
Chief Elms, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. The Department would like the record to show that each of the cases the Commission may consider today have been reviewed. It's been determined that the cases meet the criteria established in Arizona Revised Statute 17238, 17245, 17340, 17362, 17363, and or 17502 for Commission action. The record should reflect that the Commission and the respondents have been provided copies of original court dockets and case reports prepared by the officer, along with copies of the other pertinent material in each of these cases. All of these exhibits may be considered by the Commission in order to make a final determination in each of these cases. Please note that each individual is legally noticed for today's hearing. Normally I read those names, but we only have one person noticed for today's hearing, and he told me he wasn't coming. So I will dispense with that. The civil assessment process is not intended to be punitive, but is a process allowing the Commission to recover financial damages and compensate the state for any lost wildlife. Hunter education requirements are imposed as a remedial measure to increase knowledge and prevent future violations and not as punishment. The Department is ready to present these cases for possible revocation and or civil assessment action and have the Commission take jurisdiction.
I have a motion by Commissioner Guggenhammer.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Buchanan. Any discussion? All those in favor of taking jurisdiction signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Go ahead, Chief.
Mr. Chair, the only revocation on this agenda item is Docket 2025-0016, named Joseph Martin, located in Illinois, 62258, conviction summary, citation C50850, count A, possess unlawfully taken mule deer, count B, take mule deer without a valid permit, count C, take mule deer without a valid license, citation C50851, count A, export unlawfully taken mule deer, the courts of Virginia Justice Court, plea on count, on citation 50850, count C is guilty, 50851, count A is guilty. All other charges are dismissed for the plea agreement. Sentenced to pay a fine of $1,500 on January 29, 2025. Actions to be considered: revocation of license to take wildlife pursuant to ARS 17340, required completion under education course pursuant to ARS 17245. Civil damage is no less than $3,852.38. For the loss of one mule deer pursuant to ARS 17314. Mr. Martin is not present. Would you like me to read the case summary?
I don't think so. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, in this case, the case officer is also not present. I do have a letter I received from Mr. Martin last evening, and I can read it to the commission on his behalf.
Please do.
Hello, Chief Elms and Arizona Game and Fish Commission. First, I would like to apologize for not being able to attend the hearing today. Secondly, I would like to apologize for being convicted of an illegal take of a mule deer. I was an Arizona resident for 4 years and learned to love the state of Arizona and the animals I was allowed to hunt in it. I have never been convicted of any crime in my entire life, and all of the court dates, fees, punishments, and stress this issue has caused me, I will never think about breaking the law again. As I stated, I cherish the opportunity to get to hunt in these amazing big game animals in the state of Arizona, and I am ashamed that I have used this privilege. I know that I will be looking for at additional fines, but please take this apology into consideration when deciding the length of my license revocation. I have learned my lesson. I will never abuse this privilege again. I thank you for your time and efforts to maintain the population of these big game animals for the great state of Arizona. Thank you, Joseph Martin.
Thank you, Chief. So we have nothing further. We don't have an officer. We don't have Mr. Martin, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Any questions or comments from the commission? Do I have a motion?
I'll make it.
Commissioner Buchanan.
I move that the license and or license privileges of Joseph A. Martin to hunt, fish, and trap in the state of Arizona be revoked and that he be denied another for a period of 5 years. That the current license be suspended as of the date of this hearing and that it be revoked as of the date the order in this case assigned by the director. That he be required to complete the hunter education course and provide proof to the department before applying for any other license to hunt in this state. That the department be directed to collect civil damages or to bring civil action against Joseph A. Martin to collect the amount of $3,852.38 for the loss of one mule deer. And I further move that the director, as secretary to the commission, be directed to sign and issue a finding of fact, conclusion of law, and an order in this matter pursuant to this motion.
Second.
I have a motion by Commissioner Buchanan, a second by Vice Chair Sue. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion carries unanimously. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, just as a reminder, every time we have an out-of-state resident who is revoked, I would ask you to follow up with that state and make sure they're tracking this action as well.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Buchanan. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Elms, with regard to that. Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, while we have Chief Elms at the lectern, I recommend we go to item 7, which is rehearing request regarding previous license revocation and civil assessment. The presenter would be Gene Elms, Law Enforcement Branch Chief.
Chief Elms.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, on October 17, 2024, Vincent De Leon was convicted in the Presses Justice Court on account A, take elk and allow edible portions to go to waste, count B, litter while hunting, and fine $1,040. On February 14, 2025, the Commission revoked Mr. De Leon's hunting, fishing, and trapping license to take wildlife in the state of Arizona for up to 3 years and further required him to complete a hunter education course before obtaining any other license to take wildlife in the state of Arizona. Mr. De Leon has requested a rehearing in this matter and decision due to not receiving his notice prior to the meeting. He has been noticed for this meeting via certified mail. Mr. De Leon was legally noticed for the original hearing. The hearing notice requires signature from a person. The notice was attempted to be delivered 3 times and it was not accepted or signed for. We should also note that the finding of facts was also sent to the same address, which was signed for, and that's what prompted his request for this rehearing. Mr. De Leon is not present.
Are there any questions for Chief Elms on this?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion. I move that the commission affirm its original decision in this matter of Vincent A. De Leon and that the petition for a rehearing be denied.
I have a motion by Commissioner Guggenhauer. I have a second by Vice Chair Sue. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion carries unanimously. Mr. Director, before we go to the next item, can we take a 5-minute break? Very good. 5 minutes, folks.
We're on.
Cool.
Thank you.
We're back in session, Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, that brings us back to item 5, Species of Greatest Conservation Need. Briefing, the presenter is Jennifer Pressler, Birds and Mammals Biologist.
Ms. Pressler, good morning.
Push your button.
Is your button on?
Try again. Is that better?
Perfect.
All right. Good morning, Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Jennifer Pressler. I'm non-game birds and mammals biologist in our terrestrial wildlife branch. And today I'm here to give you an update on the black-tailed prairie dog reintroduction project. Next slide. So to start off, I just want to give a little bit of history of black-tailed prairie dogs in the state. So in the early 1900s, the black-tailed prairie dog, well, prairie dogs in general were considered an agricultural pest, and there was a widespread campaign across the United States to try to eliminate them from the habitat, and there was just a widespread poisoning campaign. Arizona was the only state that was actually successful in eliminating them from the landscape, though populations were extremely decreased across their range. So by the 1960s, by the early 1960s, prairie dogs were extirpated in Arizona. So between the 1960s and the early 2000s, we really started noticing what happens when there's no prairie dogs on the landscape. We started to see some detrimental effects across the ecosystem, some of which I'll get into on the next slide, but we decided as a state that we should work towards putting them back on the landscape, returning them, and reintroducing them to Arizona. So in 2008, we added the first black-tailed prairie dogs back to the state, starting with a colony in southeastern Arizona, translocated from New Mexico, and we've been working on reintroducing them since then. Next slide. So the big question of why introduce? Other than the main reason of, you know, a lot of what we do here at Arizona Game and Fish is trying to restore native species to the landscape, we did see that the prairie dogs provided a benefit ecosystem-wide. They can reduce mesquite and woody vegetation encroachment on the grasslands because anytime any woody vegetation starts to sprout on a prairie dog colony, they clip it down. They don't want anything taller than them on the landscape, so they immediately reduce any mesquite that pops up growing. The photo I have here on this slide, too, is a perfect example of the colony providing a natural fire break. This picture was taken this past fall. We had a fire that started on Highway 82, and it burned directly towards one of our, well, our newest reintroduction colony, unfortunately, in a case of really bad timing. But it was also adjacent to one of our, or actually our first established colony from 2008. So in that photo, you can see the tan section where it didn't burn is exactly the colony outline, and the rest where it burned completely around. And this helped the firefighters gain control of that fire, and they were actually able to stop it kind of right at that colony, you know, showing that the colonies have a natural purpose on the landscape. They also increase native grass diversity, can increase water retention on the landscape, just the way their burrow systems are built, can help replenish the water system by preventing water runoff, as well as other species benefits that you've got there in that other photo, some burrowing owls that we frequently see at the prairie dog colonies, as well as we regularly see pronghorn at the colonies. It seems like they like some of the native grasses and forbs that are more likely to grow in the colonies, as well as they also appreciate the line of sight away from, you know, to be able to view predators coming towards them. Next slide. So here I just have some background on the listing status of black-tailed prairie dogs. While they are not listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened or endangered, They are considered a species of greatest conservation need in Arizona. They were petitioned to be listed under the ESA two different times. The first time was in the super early 2000s. They were first petitioned to be listed, and they were decided to be a candidate species, but eventually were taken off listing due to lack of data surrounding their actual presence on the landscape, as well as underestimation potentially of the effects of plague on the colonies. So basically there just wasn't enough data to decide to list it at that time. But in 2007, they were petitioned again to be listed. And this was right around the time when Arizona was working towards the reintroduction effort. And one of the main reasons that they cited when they precluded it from being listed in 2009 was the effort that Arizona Game and Fish was working to put back prairie dogs and fill in one of the large gaps of unoccupancy on the landscape. And if you'd noticed a couple slides before, I had the range of black-tailed prairie dogs in across the U.S. And though other states, many other states have a larger area where black-tailed prairie dog ranges, and Arizona is kind of just a small corner, the fact that they are completely gone from Arizona was a rather large chunk of continuous habitat that no longer had prairie dogs on the landscape. And so adding them back to our state was one of the main reasons they decided not to list. Next slide. So currently in the state, we have seven reintroduction colonies that we have put out on the landscape, covering state trust land, BLM land, Pima County land, and also private property, as well as two colonies that the prairie dogs have dispersed to on their own, where they have been graciously allowed to stay by a private landowner. Next slide. So when Arizona was first planning on reintroducing black-tailed prairie dogs to the state, a management plan was created with three main goals. The first goal was 7,100 acres of black-tailed prairie dog colonies in the state, which is a really large goal, and we are still fairly far off of that. But the second goal of black-tailed prairie dogs occupying three of their four native counties in the state, we have actually achieved fairly. We dip right into Santa Cruz County, otherwise we occupy Pima and Cochise County. And our third main goal was connectivity between the colonies. And we have that on a small scale between a few of our colonies, but some of them are pretty far apart, so we have quite a ways to go before they all connect. Next slide. So we put a lot of work into maintaining and monitoring these colonies that we have. Monitoring includes trapping events twice a year and quarterly visual counts, where we're able to look at the overwinter survival as well as pup production. This time of year, we'll be heading out sometime this month to look at how many pups are popping up above ground, as well as numbers going into the winter and things like that, as well as annual perimeter mapping, where we can monitor the occupied acreage that the prairie dogs are using. And we do that typically in the fall. After monsoons, it's really easy to see the colony perimeters of where they're using the grass and mowing the grass down before it dies off, as well as site maintenance. We don't need to do these terribly often, but we can help the prairie dogs mow the grass in the case of like really extreme weather events, if there's a ton of moisture and it's hard for these new colonies to keep up on keeping the grass at a level where they can still see each other and communicate, as well as mesquite removal. Like I said, they prevent any new growth from popping up, but as the colonies expand, if they expand into areas that have older, mature trees, we can help clear those out as needed as well. We have had to do some drought mitigation. We do supplementally feed the prairie dogs in the dry spring and summer months before monsoons, just as they're reestablishing to help get them by in that really dry time. It seems to help with pup production while we're really trying to help these colonies get to a level where they can really sustain themselves on their own. As well as colony watering, this is the first one. We only did that directly related to that fire that came through, which happened only 3 days after we had put those prairie dogs out there. They were all fine underground, but the fire completely decimated their food source. So, and then our management recommendation sign I have up there is our hunting closure. While we're reintroducing these guys, we don't allow for any hunting of black-tailed prairie dogs, just to aid in our efforts to reintroduce them. Next slide. So this is our black-tailed prairie dog population over time. couple things to note here. That black diagonal line that goes upward is our average linear growth trend. So as you can see, the prairie dog population is growing in the state. Since we put them out in 2008, it's kind of on a upward trend overall. But that blue line shows the actual population over time. So it shows it year to year. Some things that I find really interesting to note there are, if you pay attention, or if you know some history on Arizona in our periods of drought, 2016 and 2017 were a couple of very dry years, with a little bit of an increase in rain in 2018, as well as 2019 and 2020 being another set of really dry years, whereas 2021 and 2022 were pretty wet, and then again we've had two monsoon seasons in a row that have been really poor in southeastern Arizona. I recently saw a map that NOAA put out that was showing like the areas of severe drought in the state, and that portion of southeastern Arizona was the darkest red severe drought area in the state. So some of our colleagues just have received fractions of an inch of rain, which makes it challenging. So with that, though we're kind of on an upward trend, a pretty good upward trend between like 2002 and 2004, I at this point do expect a pretty severe drop-off after we've had been dealing with this drought for a couple of years now in a row. That being said, though that there are these periods where the population declines, the prairie dogs have still been able to support themselves and remain on the landscape. So I think, you know, even if the populations decline, it shows that we will be able to hopefully rebound and the line will continue on an overall upward trajectory. Another thing to note here is that the last time we actually pulled prairie dogs in from another state was 2017. So since 2017, we've been using prairie dogs within Arizona for translocations. So even though starting in that year, we stopped bringing prairie dogs in, the growth did continue. So we aren't necessarily reliant on other states or other populations to help support us. So that's pretty cool. Next slide. And then on kind of that same topic of drought, this is one of our larger colonies, just the perimeters that we've mapped over time. And you can see kind of the same trend here if you know, were to compare it to the previous slide, the areas where there's growth and then decrease, you can see the colonies kind of growing and contracting, like from 2020 to 2021, it really kind of shrunk down and then kind of was able to rebound. And so this is another, I just thought it was a nice visual example of how the prairie dogs are remaining on the landscape, but you know, they're able to thrive a little bit more when there's periods of a little bit more rain, a little bit more to eat. Next slide. So recently, our most recent translocation efforts include last year we had a really large scale translocation. We did two different translocations. We moved 100 prairie dogs within Arizona and created a new colony here, as well as translocating 98 individuals down to Mexico. When we were first starting to reintroduce in 2010, we had a translocation of prairie dogs from Mexico to the U.S., and we had always agreed to give those prairie dogs back once we were at a point where we could support it. And so it was exciting to see that we were at that point, and we were able to complete one of the largest small mammal translocations in the state and one of the largest to Mexico last year. And then in the future, we hope to continue the same project, continue adding colonies here in Arizona, as well as potentially adding more to Mexico, continue working with the prairie dog conservation team to coordinate prairie dog conservation across the range, as well as working with different land management agencies and private landowners here in the state to be able to help focus our efforts here and have more projects completed. We're also looking at correlating the success of colonies with the different soil types, vegetation types, elevation, moisture, things like that, to try to find, you know, these perfect spots where hopefully prairie dogs can thrive here in the future. It seems like, as one example, one of the colonies that they've moved to on their own is a spot where they've done really, really well, and so we're kind of hoping to use that as an example to find similar spots where they can hopefully keep adding to that growth. Next slide. And that's all I have, but I believe I have time for a couple of questions if anybody has any, but thank you.
You have time for all the questions that we can come up with. Commissioner Buchanan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Jennifer. It's good, always good to hear your detailed presentations. I have some questions and some comments.
Okay.
So I'm going to start first with, I think the last time you and I talked about this, we were talking about taking a hard look at the San Rafael Valley, and in particular the state conservation area that's down there on the San Rafael Ranch. Have you made any progress on that?
Chairman, Commissioner, yes, I have been looking at working on the San Rafael grasslands area down there. I think that grassland is one of the most pristine in the state, and it would be great habitat for black-tailed prairie dogs, as well as being just across the border from the translocation that we did in Mexico, so it would really help provide connectivity between the population there and in Arizona. One of my biggest challenges as far as finding spots to do translocations is that we have a 2-mile buffer self-imposed where we aren't allowed to put a colony of prairie dogs within 2 miles of any landowners that are unsupportive of the project. So that is our biggest hurdle. It's really difficult to find 4 straight miles of land without any neighbors that aren't supportive. We have been working with state parks as well as the landowner down there to hopefully figure out a path forward to be able to.
Mr. Humphreys?
Yes.
Yeah. So I've talked to a number of ranchers down there, and some of them tell me, well, we can't have prairie dogs because my horses are going to break their legs. And I point to pocket gopher holes that are all over the landscape. And I say, you know, horses don't break their legs in pocket gopher holes, so please help educate me here. But I don't think we, the department, are going to win anybody over on this. I think the most effective means would be to find another rancher who has prairie dogs and knows that it's not really a big deal. So I'd point you towards Mr. Austin out in Cochise County. I don't know what we can do to enlist his help to talk to other ranchers, but that would be, I think, far more effective than us talking to ranchers to make that happen. The other thing that I wanted to ask you is whether or not you'd ever thought about working with Fort Huachuca on this.
Chairman, Commissioner Buchanan, yes, to your first point, I would also like to point out that all of our active prairie dog colonies are on active cattle ranches, and so far we haven't had any issues or conflicts with cattle and horses or anything like that with the holes. There are, you know, plenty of other holes from other animals, kangaroo, rats, gophers, things like that on the landscape, and so it's hard to want to pinpoint the problem on prairie dog holes when there's so many other holes out there, but we do have great relationships with a couple ranchers, and I also am hoping that that's our path forward by, you know, kind of having a community level engagement on the topic of prairie dogs. It's hard to, you know, come from Phoenix and try to start that discussion as an outsider. To your second point, yes, I have talked some with Fort Huachuca about potentially adding prairie dogs there. One of our first studies that was done in the early 2000s prior to reintroductions was looking at both La Cienega's National Conservation Area as well as Fort Huachuca to look at habitat suitability, and it was determined that Fort Huachuca does have suitable habitat for prairie dogs. I haven't been able to get a yes answer to be able to work directly on there, but I have been trying to make contact.
Thanks. You know, there's some great pronghorn habitat there, which is also great black-tailed prairie dog habitat, and we've been trying to work with them on pronghorn population management. Not a whole lot of success, but I'd ask you to work with our Region 5 supervisor here, and if I can help you on the military side, I'm very happy to. I think it'd be easy to do, great to do, actually good for them, and like you speak to Supervisor Kloss in Region 4, you know, when you can get DOD on your side, they tend to bring a lot of resources to help you out on some of these things. So I think that might be worth considering. Last question really has to do with black-footed ferrets. So we've talked in the past about Gunnison Prairie Dogs up in northern Arizona, and what sort of viable population, minimal conditions do we need from prairie dog populations in order to reintroduce black-footed ferrets? And I know this is a down-the-road kind of thing we're looking at in southeastern Arizona, but I'd like to know, what would it take, and what's the possibility of getting there?
Yeah, Chairman, Commissioner Buchanan, thank you for the questions, and thank you for the support. So as far as black-footed ferrets, our research shows that one single ferret can eat as many as 100 prairie dogs in 1 year, which at this point, with our colonies as small as they are, would entirely decimate our population if we had just one, let alone a family of them. So I think it is written into the statewide 10J to allow for ferrets to be reintroduced down there in the future if we have enough prairie dogs to support it. But we're at this point fairly far off on the acreage goal that we would be hoping for to be able to support that.
And then I guess one last follow-on. So major predators right now, coyotes and red tails, or what is eating them?
Chairman, Commissioner, for the most part, the main predators, would be coyotes. If a badger takes up residence, they can eat quite a few prairie dogs. We've had bobcats that hang around the colony. Golden eagles love them, as well as, red tails, frugenous hawks, things like that.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Guggenhauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the call, Jennifer, and the information. We talked a little bit about the collaboration that's going on with other states here. And could you just say a few words about, great that these are not warranted to be listed, avoided that a couple of times because of those collaborations. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Chairman, Commissioner, thank you for the question. We do work with the other states. We have the Prairie Dog Conservation Team, which has representative from all the states in the Prairie Dog Range. And most of the states are doing conservation work to help the black-tailed prairie dog populations because they have been in decline pretty much all the way across their range. A lot of the other states focus their management on Sylvatic plague control, which we luckily have not had in our black-tailed prairie dog colonies, but they focus their efforts on that as well as hoping to focus the black-tailed prairie dog populations in their black-footed ferret recovery areas. But most of the other states, as they didn't kill them off or extirpate them like we did in the early 1900s, they have larger populations and more connectivity. And so a lot of the management and survey that they do is on an acreage, like hundreds of thousands of acreage level compared to our almost individual management. But it's good to have contacts throughout the states and be able to, work with them and look at the different translocation techniques they're using and things like that to be able to collaborate and use, the latest techniques.
Thank you. You're doing great work on an important topic. Thanks for doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Nice work, Mr. Chairman. Item 8 is Willow Beach Fishing Pier Cleanup. The presenter is Scott Osborne, Wildlife Manager in Region 3.
Officer Osborne, good morning.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the Commission. My name is Scott Osborne. I'm the Wildlife Manager for the Lake Mead District in Region 3 here. I've been with the department since 2013, and today I'm here to present the region's work in the Willow Beach Fishing Pier Cleanup. Now, like many of the interesting stories wildlife managers tell, this story started with a concerned member of the public calling in a potential crime to our dispatch. The call came in January of 2023 when a local diver was diving off the fishing pier at Willow Beach and saw more than a dozen ducks strung up, which he described in rope anchored to the bottom of the river, and this called for an investigation, clearly. Unfortunately, the water at Willow Beach is very cold. And in January, with the temperatures low and the water sitting around 55 degrees, I needed to get a little bit of help. And that help came in the form of the National Park Service's dive team. Next slide, please. So two divers met me at the very next day and retrieved over a dozen ducks and other waterfowl, mostly coots, some grebes, but also a few mallards and redheads. It was obvious at that point that we had a problem. The divers said that there was more line, fishing line, and they themselves were also getting tangled in it. So we've all been fishing before. You cast a line out, start reeling it back in, and you get snagged on something. Sometimes you can wiggle it free, and unfortunately sometimes that lure and that line get broke and they're stuck in the water there. So over the course of years, that can build up, and eventually you can end up with what we had. Now we do all kinds of cleanups in the region, from target shooting cleanups with the BLM to off-highway cleanups with other OHV clubs. Never had I been involved in an underwater cleanup. So it takes a certain set of skills, equipment, certifications. You can't just walk out there and start picking up trash. So we needed help, and we needed some partners. Next slide, please. Those partners were the National Park Service up on Lake Mead and the Nevada Department of Wildlife. So some of the most important things you can do as a wildlife manager is develop your relationships, whether it's landowners, ranchers, or other agencies that have a stake in your district. I've worked with the National Park Service and Nevada Department of Wildlife over the years. I've backed up their law enforcement officers on dozens of calls, as they have for me. I've been on eagle surveys, sheep captures with them. I've gone out on human-wildlife interactions, nuisance wildlife calls with their biologists. I've even sat on boats to provide security for the divers as they remove things like stolen vehicles from the bottom of Lake Mojave, or the ever so often body recoveries that we have to do on the river. Years of interagency cooperation made this coordination possible. Next slide, please. So for me, I coordinated this project. I wrote up our safety plan. Part of that plan was to have law enforcement out to make sure people weren't fishing on top of our divers as they were in the water. We also brought a boat down there for additional diver safety and quick extraction in case of an incident. We also brought the Region 3 cook trailer, which is also very nice, for some after-action barbecue as a thank you to all that helped out. Next slide, please. The National Park Service at Lake Mead provided a very experienced dive team. Lots of members, they dive all the time. They also helped with the temporary closure of the fishing pier. Anytime you want to close part of a national park, it can be difficult, but luckily the park was on board from the get-go and we didn't have any issues. They also provided some law enforcement park rangers to help with public interaction, answer the many questions that popped up. Next slide, please. The Nevada Department of Wildlife also provided the dive team from their fisheries department. They provided law enforcement officers. One of them was a great cook that manned the barbecue that day. A ton of local volunteers also came from the local areas, Boulder City, Las Vegas, and Henderson. They helped sort, weigh the debris that we removed. Next slide, please. So the day of the event, we had a pre-operational planning meeting where we went over all the safety stuff, make sure everyone was on the same page. We met and discussed the safety plan, went over everyone's role and responsibilities. Diver safety was the most important factor, and thankfully we had no incidents that day. Next slide, please. Now, unexpected difficulties are always expected in this line of work. This cleanup was no different. As you can see from the slide, the water at Willow Beach is exceptionally clear. That is until you start rooting around below the water and start digging out some of the lures that they found. You get some debris, and monofilament can be very difficult to see in some murky water. This resulted in occasionally divers getting tangled up in some of the line, but it wasn't a problem and it didn't keep us from completing the mission. Next slide, please. All the agencies involved worked together and managed to get the water near the fishing pier cleaned up. From the divers in the water to the wildlife managers on the safety boat to the park rangers speaking to the public, that had many questions, it all went to plan. And most importantly, everyone stayed safe. Next slide, please. So we managed to remove over 146 pounds of trash, line, lures, other debris from the discarded traffic barricades, beer and soda bottles, hundreds of feet of monofilament line, and dozens of lures. The cleanup at Willow Beach was a success. Next slide, please. The Nevada Department of Wildlife assisted in bringing nearly a dozen volunteers that aided in sorting, categorizing, and weighing the trash. They also managed to clean up the discarded fishing lures. Now, these lures were donated to the local Boulder City Youth Bass Club, and we all know how expensive fishing equipment can be, so I'm sure these kids were happy to receive these donations. Next slide, please. So nothing is quite better after a hard day work than having a little barbecue with friends and colleagues, some burgers, some hot dogs, chips and soda. A nice thank you for all the help these amazing people provided. Next slide, please. So we coordinated a second cleanup in the fall of 2023. Additional line, lure, and trash were removed. We are still monitoring the water near the pier and have not received any additional calls of ducks being caught in fishing line. The NPS dive team continues to dive the fishing pier annually in a monitoring effort. Now, this is just a showcase of some of the amazing work we do up here in Region 3. Thank you for your time.
I'm Sir Osborne. I have to tell you that I love these stories when we've got our WMs out in the community doing things. And this looks like it was an incredibly important stuff, but it was also quite an undertaking. And then I want to commend you and your department for reaching out and working with the other agencies. I mean, I know you do that regularly, but we don't get to see it enough. Sure. And I think it's important, and it's a testament both to your agency as well as to Arizona Game and Fish. It looked like it was really something. I mean, I've seen and participated in different cleanups, but never in a dive suit. So thank you very much for this. Appreciate it. Any other comments? Vice Chairman Sue.
Thank you so much for your work. It's just amazing the amount of stuff that you brought up. How often do you do this kind of cleanup? Is it on a regular basis, or is it just when you see some of the wildlife being affected by it?
Chairman, Commissioner Sue, yeah, it depends. It really does. Some of the target shooting cleanups might be annually, biannually, depending on the need. This was a special one that it's hard to see what's under the water sometimes, even from a boat. So it's kind of a case-by-case basis.
Good. Thank you.
Anybody else? Officer, thank you. We really appreciate your time.
Nice work, Scott. Do we have any of that after-action barbecue available?
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you. Nice job. Mr. Chairman, item 9 is Shooting Range Development Grant Request for FY 2026. The presenter is Matt Schwarzkopf, Statewide Shooting Range Administrator.
Mr. Schwarzkopf, good morning. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. Before I get started, I'm Matt Schwarzkopf, like the Director said. I wanted to thank the Commission for recognizing the Tri-State Shooting Park this morning. Not only do they run a commission-owned range, but they also are heavily involved in the community, and you saw one of those examples this morning. And one of the things I wanted to point out, you saw all the people up here. During the month of April, the Tri-State Shooting Park logged almost 1,300 volunteer hours for the department.
Nice.
So, I mean, they are heavily active. That group, they're a very active and passionate group for running the shooting range and promoting shooting in the Bullhead City area. So, thank you.
Thank you.
So, next slide, please. So here I'm here to present on the Commission Shooting Range Development Grants. To give you a little bit of background on the grants, in 1996, the Commission created the Shooting Range Development Grant Program to encourage the development and improvement of shooting. Of course, we all know, you know, shooting ranges are important to provide shooters and hunters a place to go practice, and then also that also provides shooters to go a place to go buy guns and ammo, which increases PR dollars, which of course increases wildlife conservation efforts. So the Commission was very smart back then in developing this and creating a program to increase and develop the shooting ranges around the state. Next slide, please. So for the grant, eligible applicants are sportsmen's clubs and organizations and government agencies. Just there's one note there, privately owned and for-profit ranges are not eligible for this program. Next slide, please. So the grant requirements, all applicants must provide a minimum of 50% match towards the grant. The grant can be matched with cash, donated labor, materials, and land and other monies or donations. Completed projects must be maintained for public use for a period of 10 years. And then additionally, the grant acceptance of the grant requires that the range be made available for Arizona Game and Fish Department activities such as hunter education, archery and shooting sports education programs, recruitment, retention, and reactivation efforts, and the Scholastic Clay Target Program. All right, next slide, please. All right, for fiscal year 26, there is $100,000 available. One note here, applicants in the application, they can elect to receive partial funding. And then for fiscal year 26, the department received 4 grant applications requesting $154,139. So this application process is a competitive process. As you can see, there's only $100,000 available. A team of 5 department employees are selected to make up the evaluation team and score the applications and prioritize them. The applications are scored by a published criteria in the application packet. The criteria that the applications are scored on include items such as the improves range safety, increases public usefulness, supports shooting programs and education shooting programs, supports the shooting sports, benefits the community, and of course the application is clear, complete, and all requested information is provided. And of course we also evaluate to make sure all the expenditures in the application are eligible for the grant. So with that, like I said, there's $100,000 available, so the department will be asking the commission to vote to approve 3 of these applications. Next slide, please. The first grant application was the city of Buckeye. As many are aware, the Joe Foss shooting range was closed down by the county. There was some stuff going on there, but now the city of Buckeye has the lease on that, on the Joe Foss range, and they are going to be operating it. And at the Joe Foss range, there are 2 archery ranges there. They're in pretty disrepair, so they are asking for $75,732 to enhance and reopen 2 archery ranges at the Joe Foss shooting complex. The department will be recommending funding this application for a total of $48,500. Next slide, please. The White Mountain Clay Targets Club in Sholo, Arizona, they are requesting $6,000 for the maintenance and on the range entrance and access road. If anyone's been there, they have a long access road to their range, and it takes a lot of maintenance to keep it accessible to the range. So the department will be recommending funding the total amount of the application request. Next slide, please. Next application was the city of Yuma. Yuma requested $45,500 for the installation of a shade canopy over the firing line at the Pacific Avenue Athletic Complex Archery Range. This archery range was actually 2 fiscal years ago that the commission approved money to establish this archery range. It is established now and now an opening. So the next stage, The next stage is obviously to put the canopy over the firing line, because we all know how hot it is and can be in Yuma. So the department will be recommending funding the total amount of the application. And the last application the department received was the Sierra Vista Rod and Gun Club, located in Sierra Vista. The Sierra Vista Rod and Gun Club requested $26,907 for the replacement of a metal canopy on range 4 of the range. Unfortunately, the department will not be recommending funding this application. Next slide, please. I do have a recommendation, but before anyone has any questions.
Before that, Mr. Schwarzkopf,
we have some questions, I think. Commissioner Buchanan?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, Matt, and it has to do with your statement up front about eligibility criteria. This might apply to the Buckeye Range, but it certainly applies to something else that is in the works maybe for next year. And that is, you said privately owned ranges were not eligible, but my belief was that they are if they're leased to a government entity like the city of Buckeye or whatever for the operation. Is that correct?
Correct. Kind of correct, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Buchanan. For example, the White Mountain Clay Targets Club, they own that property, but there are several other ranges that are leased, you know, and it's by a entity, but they're a nonprofit entity that leases the range through a government organization, and they are eligible.
Okay.
Any other questions? Vice Chairman Sue.
Thank you so much. Interesting report. I have a question. That very first slide with the target, with the hole in the middle, is that yours?
Commissioner, or Chairman Hernandez, Commissioner Sue, yes, that is mine.
I knew that. I've seen that before.
Yes.
That, congratulations on a match well run, and I'm glad you did as well as you did. It's great.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kerr.
As a frequent user of the road to the White Mountain Clay Target facility, I'm really pleased to see you recommend and give the $6,000 to the road. We're out there twice a month with my kids to coach and to get them to practice. So I appreciate that.
Perfect. All right. Mr. Schwarzkopf, you have a recommendation?
Yes. The department recommends that the commission vote to approve the shooting range grant applications for the fiscal year 26 grant cycle as presented for the total of $100,000.
Commissioner Kerr?
I wholeheartedly move that you accept.
Second.
That recommendation.
I have a motion by Commissioner Kerr, a second by Vice Chairman Sue. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Schwarzkopf.
Thank you, Director. Chairman, members of the commission.
Thank you, Matt. Nice work. Mr. Chairman, agenda item 10 is a first read item. The commission may choose to take action on first read items as needed or may direct the department to place the first read items on the consent agenda for approval at the next commission meeting. Item 10 is an agreement for the permit with the town of Pine Top Lakeside for the purpose of providing access to the White Mountain Trail across the commission's Pine Top Regional Office, Navajo County, Arizona. The presenter is Jim Ruff, Land and Water Program Supervisor.
Mr. Director, I think that's item 11. So item 11, not item 10. Am I correct in that?
We're going to hold off on item 11 for a while. This is item 10 on my agenda.
That's because I got a new agenda.
Oh, okay. Very well. That's fine. I have the old one as well. I apologize. Then we're on item 10, and Mr. Ruff, good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Finley, and good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. I am going to be presenting a renewal for the license agreement for the White Mountain Trail across the Pine Top Regional Office property today. For the record, my name is Jim Ruff. I'm the Land and Water Program Supervisor at the department. So first slide, please. So the town of Pine Top Lakeside requested that the current agreement that we have for access, maintenance, and public use of the White Mountain Trail across the Pine Top Regional Office property be extended for another 10 years. The existing agreement has been in place since 2015, and again, this is a renewal of that agreement. The department has determined that this agreement is in the public interest and is compatible with the operation of the Pine Top Regional Office. The new license agreement will be valid for 10 years and will allow the town of Pine Top Lakeside to continue to provide the necessary operation and maintenance of the trail, which they have done for the last 10 years. and provide access across that property. Next slide, please. Wanted to show you a map of the Pine Top Regional Office property. This is a 41-acre commissioned-owned property in Pine Top. It was acquired from the U.S. Forest Service in 1963 through a land patent. You can see the boundary of the property outlined in, I guess it's green, maybe blue.
Turquoise.
And the public White Mountain Trail is shown in purple on the north side of the property that runs along Billy Creek. Note that there's also a trail spur that provides public access from the regional office parking lot to the trail. Next slide. So that's all I have. Unless you have some questions for me, I have a recommendation.
Any questions for Mr. Ruff? Hearing none. Go ahead, Mr. Ruff.
Okay. The department recommends that the commission direct the department to place this item on the consent agenda for the next regular commission meeting.
Do I have any objection to that?
We don't have to.
Very good. Then we will do so. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Chairman, we're going to skip ahead a little bit to item 14, state and federal legislation. The presenter is Ed Sanchez, Legislative Policy Administrator.
I thought there was some rule where Mr. Sanchez couldn't speak until the afternoon. I don't think I've ever seen him in the morning except for introduction. So
he'll energize you.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, or good morning, sorry, Mr. Sanchez.
Yep, good morning again, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. For the record, Ed Sanchez, legislative liaison for the department. Happy to provide a very brief legislative affairs update for all of you. Next slide, please. Yes, I just want to give you a quick update on the budget. There's a budget watch. The supplemental budget was passed a couple weeks ago in April 24th. And what that does, it triggers more focus now on the, it had slowed down since then. So now it's starting to speed up. And the focus now is really on the budget. The House and the Senate took a recess. The House is in recess until May 19th. The Senate's in recess until May 28th. But of course, if there's some type of budget deal that happens between them, they'll all come back. But no, we haven't heard a lot of progress on the budget, but this recess is one of the reasons why they're going to really focus in, laser in on the budget, and hopefully they get to some resolution soon. Again, the days, we're at 117 days. And just a reminder to all the commission members that the fiscal budget ends June 30th. So that is that's the timeline that the legislature needs to look at. They need to have a budget completed by June 30th. So that's likely the longest time that we will go until we see some type of budget. But hopefully, again, we'll see something sooner than that. Next slide, please. Again, a quick update on some of the legislation we've been watching and monitoring. HB 2603, this was passed the week after the last commission meeting, so I wanted to bring the slide on just to remind them that the deferred prosecution legislation was signed by the governor on April 14th. And so, as you recall, that is addresses deferred prosecutions and wildlife crimes that are charged through Title 13. So. Hooray for us. We got that across the finish line with the governor signing it.
Excuse me, Mr. Sanchez. Commissioner Buchanan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And this is probably for Council Odenkirk. And I'm not, I'm trying to understand the impact of this on timing. So as I understood it, once it's approved into law, it goes into effect in 90 days. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so here's the hypothetical.
I'm sorry. It goes into effect 90 days after they adjourn.
After they adjourn?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so then the hypothetical is if we have somebody, say, in that period, that is between that 90-day period, we still cannot take jurisdiction on a deferred prosecution, even if the timing that they would come to us is after that period. See, and the same goes for an article or for a Title 13 violation. In that period in between, when it's a kind of a gray zone, even if they come to us after the fact, could we take jurisdiction or not?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Buchanan, it's one of the things we'll need to look at. If the scenario that I'm thinking about is after the statute goes into effect, and then you have somebody who's entered into a deferred prosecution perhaps just prior to that, but it comes to the commission after the statute goes into effect, the question is whether it can be applied retroactively to that individual. And I need to spend a little bit more time looking into that, but I understand your question.
Go ahead, Ed.
Thank you. Next slide, please. SB 1211, the Publication Revolving Fund, that continues to be awaiting a final vote in the House. I know it's been viewed as by some members as a budget bill. I think that has somewhat cleared up, but it still sits in the House waiting for a final vote. And as I mentioned earlier about this recess we have with the legislature, David Fernandez and I will spend more time to educate members on the value of this legislation and how it's not a budget bill. So we have some time to spend with members now. So that's good news. Next slide, please. And then HB 1083, the Game and Fish Commission membership legislation. And as you heard earlier, Senator Angus mentioned that. And I wasn't going to be that detailed, but that's nice that she said that the bill would not be returning, because it was being calendared for a final vote in the Senate. It was held. So at that point, that process, David and I would continue to watch and monitor that and talk to members to make sure it didn't get back on the floor calendar. But Senator indicated that it's not going to be returning, so it's most likely dead going forward, unless it gets a final vote. This bill's dead going forward. So that's all good news. Next slide, please. Oh, that's interesting. So the 1053, the Wildlife Firearms Discharge Structures Distance Bill, that is also awaiting a final vote in the House. Actually, just as an update, this week it was placed on the House calendar for a third read, which is the final vote in the House, twice. Once on Tuesday, once on Wednesday. It actually got a technical correction on Wednesday. That also delayed it. Nothing changed the intent of the bill. I think it was more of kind of a delay for that process. So what it did, it did not get a final vote. So they're in recess. So again, David Fernandez and I will have a chance to kind of go back to members to talk to them about this bill. And of course, I want to remind you all that you did officially oppose this legislation, so we are aggressively going after members to make sure to educate and inform them on that, on your position. Next slide, please. And then finally, a quick federal update. The President's recommendations on the discretionary fiscal 26 funding levels, what they call the skinny budget, was released back in, I think it was May 2nd. Some big cuts, proposes $163 billion cut, 22.6% below this current fiscal year funding levels. So it's pretty fairly significant. Cuts in non-essential fish and wildlife grant programs of about $170 million. And I just wanted to highlight the state travel grants that the departments receive. It's about $1.2 million, but a total of $72.4 million throughout the whole country. So something we're watching out for. I understand that the entire good President's budget may most likely be released sometime next week. So we'll really get into more details on that effect. I know House Speaker Johnson mentioned that there's 11 appropriations committees going through, and I think there is 8 or 9 that are completed as of this week. And so there'll be a couple more being completed, they say, by next week. So we'll have a better picture of how this is all going to evolve going forward. But the House Speaker Johnson believes that we'll have all this kind of wrapped up by Memorial Day. And that's something that we'll have to watch. I don't know. I know historically that hasn't, they've said those type of things and it hasn't happened. And so it's turned into a CR, a continuing resolution, as you know, that will, if we get to that deadline of September 30th, the end of the fiscal year, they'll have to pass a continuing resolution. So that's the other option. They can get this all done. One more thing, just to mention, the Ways and Means Committee. They're the committee, the House committee, that actually puts together all these proposed cuts, so they can see the revenue going forward. So that I understand they're going to be releasing some information next week. So again, a more clearer picture of what we expect to see it, going forward. Next slide, please. And that, commissioners, is my presentation. I'm available for any questions.
Any questions from the commission?
Just a
Commissioner comment,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, on SB 1211, I just want you to know that the commission legislative committee members are available if there's any need for us to speak with members, or even perhaps a letter from the chairman trying to clarify that this is not a budget issue. It's just a clarification. It's a game and fish revolving fund, and we can manage that. So we're available, and we'll follow your lead on this.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Goodenow, I appreciate that. Dave and I, we've been talking about that, about strategy, so we very much appreciate that availability that you have, because we may actually be reaching out to you.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else? Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, that brings us to item 15, State and Federal Lands Planning Update. The presenter is Callie Cavalcant, Habitat Evaluation and Lands Branch Chief.
Good morning, Ms. Cavalcant.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the Commission. For the record, I am Callie Cavalcant, Habitat Evaluation and Lands Branch Chief, and with that, we will jump into the State and Federal Lands Planning Update. Next slide, please. Okay, so to start off, for today's update, we're going to highlight two federal executive orders that the department is watching. The first is the zero-based regulatory budgeting to unleash American energy. It directs federal agencies to incorporate a sunset provision into their regulations and compel those agencies to reexamine their regulations periodically to ensure that the rules continue to serve public good. This creates a process for those identified agencies to conduct a regular review of the regulations to ensure they are still meeting an effective purpose. If they are not, the regulation will cease to be effective and will be removed from the Code of Federal Regulations. If, however, during the review, it is determined that that regulation is still meeting an effective purpose, they will continue to be in effect. A quick point of clarification, the acts themselves are not subject to the sunset rule, just the regulations that the federal agencies have identified to enforce or implement those acts. There is a list here on the screen of, this is not a comprehensive list of all of the agencies and acts that are subject to the sunset rule. These are just the ones that the department and the commission will be watching. Next slide, please. The second is the Public Lands Rule, also known as the Conservation and Landscape Health Rule. This rule was finalized in June last year and recognizes conservation as a component of public lands management on equal footing with other multiple uses. The White House released a rescission notice for this rule in April, so last month. The notice is pending publication in the Federal Register as of last week, and at that time it will initiate a public comment period, which the department is watching for. Next slide, please. The Heber Wild Horse Territory Plan Environmental Assessment. They started the scoping period for development of the environmental assessment in August of 2008. In March of 2021, the draft environmental assessment and territory management plan were released for public comment. The department did comment during that period. The very last update I provided you in October, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued their final biological opinion, and we have been pending the release of that final EA, which will include a 45-day objection period. Originally, the draft decision was expected in September of this year, with implementation in October of this year. However, they recently delayed the decision to February of 2026, with implementation in March of that year. The department will continue to track this particular EA and keep the commission apprised. Next slide, please. With that, I am available for any questions. And actually, I'm sorry, before if you have any questions, I do want to mention that next month the department will be returning with our six-month more in-depth discussion and expanded report on renewable energy metrics that we track statewide. Part of that will include, hopefully, an exciting update on the department's work for our solar and wind energy guidelines, which at this point are almost finalized. So I'm looking forward to sharing more information with you on that next month.
We have any questions or comments from Ms. Cavalcant? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate
very much.
It. Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, item 16 is commission priorities update. The presenter is Luke Thompson, Special Assistant to the Director.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, good morning. I will be handling the first part of our presentation here regarding the commission priority update. As we normally do, we will pause for the commission to ask any questions, et cetera, of the priority and metric leads before we move into Karen Klima providing the expanded priority report for item 9, the resilient priority.
And Mr. Thompson and Ms. Klima, we, our Office of Klima, we should, or we may break at about a quarter till because we have some requirements as far as photographs and things like that. So I just didn't want you to get ready to go and then we stop for some reason. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that. I had two quick items that the commission was provided as an update to the original presentation regarding the landowner relations contacts. Those metrics were updated as of May 1st. From the packet the commission was provided, as well as the sport fish stocking numbers. Those slides can be accessed through the presentation. Those numbers come in after the end of the month, and the printing occurred prior to that, but we did provide that to you prior to the meeting. So with that, any questions from the commission to the priority leads?
Mr.
Chairman,
Mr.
more of a comment. Ben, could you go to slide number 5, please? Yes, I was going to make this comment in my commissioner comments, but this is probably a better place to do it. A picture is worth a thousand words. Included in April's data is the results from our latest Copper State draw, and I just wanted to acknowledge that team that planned this out, executed it perfectly. Our second highest amount that was ever revenue generated on a Copper State draw. And you can see the results there in that line. So job well done. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission.
Good morning, Supervisor Klima.
All right, so this is going to run about 25 minutes. So if for some reason you guys need to take a break and go to pictures, we'll make that happen. Next. All right, as always, here is our map of Arizona and the extreme and exceptional drought. Of course, this is a couple weeks old since you folks received your packets. And at least here in Mojave County, we've gotten about an inch and a quarter from a storm earlier this week, so that may help us out a little bit. But as you can tell, we are still combating the original thing that the commission established this priority for. Next. I'm going to go ahead and do the updates for the teams. So in the marketing team, they implemented a new year-end giving effort designed to recruit and reactivate donors, which resulted in more than $22,000 for Sendwater in December. They met and exceeded their new goals for sharing of organic reach, indicating that members of the public see this messaging as relevant and they're sharing it on their personal networks. They also proactively identifies ways to expand the reach of sending upcoming Send Water campaign efforts, including magazine, podcast, and long-form content, knowing that water hauling is ongoing and we don't see that slowing down for the foreseeable future. Next. Wanted to bring this to your attention. For the first time ever, we have hit a trigger for our biology metrics. So just to refresh that trigger, if drought conditions in an area of the state are classified as exceptional drought for four consecutive months starting in December or April, aerial or structured ground surveys should be conducted. If drought conditions are classified as extreme or exceptional drought for more than 6 months of the year, aerial or structured ground surveys will commence. And that is the trigger that we've hit. This is just Region 3 that you see on the screen, but there are 17 units around the state where we have hit this trigger, so we are going to have additional surveys this fall. Please note that the species that we are to be surveying for is not, they're not denoted in our plan, and we are limited in our capacity and funds, so we're going to be focusing mainly on deer and pronghorn extra supplemental surveys. And the units, I'm not going to rattle off all 17 units, but there's one unit, 13B, in Region 2, and then all the other units are Region 3 and Region 4. Next. I wanted to do a little bit of an in-depth dive for the new metrics that we have, these multi-year, multifaceted metrics that dealt with the hatcheries, the wildlife areas, and connectivity. So here in connectivity, we have the Willard Crossing Pilot Program, Willard Springs Wildlife Overpass Project, and this was awarded $24 million from the Federal Highway Administration, $1.5 million to Game and Fish. We were a co-applicant with ADOT on this, and construction began last month. The Wildlife Crossing Pilot Program State Action Plan, I remember Scott mentioning that yesterday, or we chatted a little bit about it yesterday. That was awarded $565,000 from Federal Highways. And again, that was a co-applicant with ADOT. Next. The Woods Canyon to Munns Park was $385,000 of non-federal, and you can see the different groups there that helped finance that. Has $1 million in NIFWA funding, and yet again, we are coordinating with ADOT. Next. BLM and WAFWA funded multi-species connectivity solar research projects. So the BLM is a $289,000 project that's west of Highway 85, and the CO Bar solar post construction deer and pronghorn movement study was funded for $202,000. So I just find it intriguing that we had such a great conversation about connectivity and the funding and all the sources and partnerships, and we're seeing that, you know, in this update right here. Next. So on to our wildlife areas. At Sipe Wildlife Area, we did a habitat restoration project on Red Creek. And the reason for this is the wildfire came through and basically filled in the stream. And so folks went out and successfully raised the stream channel, eliminated head cuts, and doing that allowed pools to reform, and then actually did native plant and fish stocking after the construction. Next. For House Rock, they are working on a bison pasture expansion and pipeline repair. So the first goal is to expand the pasture area from 4,000 to 14,000 acres by the end of this year. And more fencing will create an additional 6,000 acres late next year or early 2027. They're also planning to replace a 90-year-old pipeline with the first part of that project happening in 2027. Drilling a new well on Game and Fish property, and then constructing two additional water catchments to support bison. And I love this slide because I really think we've heard over and over about looking forward and what do we anticipate in the future. And I think this perfectly outlines, like, we need to be looking forward, and we are, and here's some of the things that we're looking at and the timelines to get it done. Next. Clough Ranch, they have an Ash Creek pipeline and diversion. So back in 2017, the Fry Fire came through and it decimated Clough and a lot of the pipelines and things that were in there. And so at this point, they have resubmitted the EAC and engineering design is underway for construction of a new diversion structure. And this pipeline will provide water to pond number 3, the irrigation ditch in pond number 1. Their second goal is to restore the water delivery infrastructure between ponds 3 and 1 and create or enhance wetland habitat, about 13 acres of moist soil units and emerging wetlands. And in that part, that specific part of the project, the EAC has been approved, the cultural survey is complete, it's undergoing SHPO, and we're estimated to start later this year for that one. Next. For our hatcheries, they are working at inspections for aquatic invasive species. So all 6 hatcheries are inspected on a regular basis. And when you see that CPR metric that talks about the various actions that we do at hatcheries, this is one of them, because I don't know if it's every month that they go out and inspect each hatchery, but they're inspecting them very frequently to ensure that AIS are not contaminating the hatchery. Next. They have also implemented actions to reduce the risk of pathogens. And so they have immersion and injection vaccines used to prevent lactococcus and installation of UV sanitizers, which help reduce pathogens and subsequently fish disease. Next. We have reached a couple triggers at both Canyon Creek and Tonto. So in December, we reached the critical flow of 1,300 gallons per minute at Canyon Creek. And so we offloaded over 5,000 pounds of trout. And then in January, we reached another trigger point for Canyon Creek and offloaded another almost additional 8,000 pounds of trout. And then we also reached a flow concern at Tonto and offloaded over 2,000 pounds of trout there. Next. All right, so diving into the infrastructure team, the boating subteam has been quite busy. They've gotten quite a bit done recently. They've implemented a comprehensive quarterly preventative maintenance schedule for all boating facilities and navigational markers, created a GPS waypoint database for all markers and buoys. Their development is underway on a construction standard for boat docks and facilities, and they're currently working to repair and update the FOLE, the field ops, boat houses on Saguaro Canyon and Apache Lakes. And those should be done. I don't have an update whether they were actually done at the end of April, but they should be done imminently. Next. The engineering design for Parker Canyon Lake is 100% done. The engineering design for Big Lake is 95% done. And Bartlett Lake, we've secured funding for a pump out boat to prevent water contamination. And then at Scorpion Bay, we're providing support to restore and maintain their pump out system. Next. I wanted to highlight Region 4 here. When we talk about our teams, we have water liaisons from every region in the state, and we all work together on the drought sub-team of this group. And Region 4 has really thought outside the box, and I wanted to give them a shout out for that. Knowing that water hauling is a big deal right now, and knowing that limiting factor is equipment, they have secured funding for at least 2 additional water trailers, borrowed 3 trucks from headquarters to use to haul those trailers, and then also brought on 2 interns for water hauling. And I also wanted to take a moment here and just give a shout out to the NGO groups, because they have been instrumental about providing support for us in this particular capacity, both labor and purchasing equipment for us so that we can get the work done. Also, ranchers aren't left out either. Some of our ranchers are the most wonderful partners. They actually allow us to pump from their wells so that we can fill up our water catchments. And so both groups have just been wonderful to work with and very supportive of the department and wildlife conservation. Next. All right, I'm not going to go through this whole slide about ranch bots. It is outdated now that we're a couple weeks down the road here. But the key messaging that we have here is all these ranch bots require subscriptions. And the subscription cost is roughly $300 a year per ranch bot. And so all the ranch bots that we have in hand, whether they're in headquarters or whether they're in the regions, they are all going to be installed by June 30th. That is our goal, to get every single one out in the landscape, get them working, get them collecting data for us, and we are on track to do that. So what we're monitoring looking forward is the balance between the how many more we want to buy versus how much the subscription costs are. And so we're evaluating that. The subscription cost for 565 ranch bots, which once we get everything in hand out, that's going to be about $175,000 every year moving forward. And so we have to plan for that in the budget and realize that at some point we're going to have so much in subscription costs that we're probably not going to be able to put out ranch bots on all 3,000 catchments.
Commissioner Klein, I'm sorry, Supervisor Klein, Commissioner Buchanan has a question.
Thanks, sure. Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Karen, for all of this detail. I would ask you to make part of your factor, you have to look at other costs. So it's not just the cost of putting out the ranch box and the cost of the subscription. You have to look at the cost of the number of what we were paying for flight hours that we don't have to do anymore, and potentially what happens when we have a, you know, what's the cost and loss of wildlife when we have a water catchment go dry. So I think that's part of that needs to be factored into this discussion. It's not just a straight single progression on a simple statistic of ranch bots in and of themselves.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Buchanan, thank you for that. And absolutely, Chris Cantrell is actually trying to work up an ROI. So not talking about truck gas, truck maintenance, people's time, people's safety. You can't put a dollar amount on somebody's safety, but we're trying to get a number so that we can show you guys the ROI of these things, because you're right, there is more than just the literal dollar for dollar. Next. So a little bit more about ranch bots. All of these are prioritized. Priorities come out of the regions, and some of the criteria that we look at are difficulty accessing the catchment, whether it's a hike only or whether it's a flight only, whether it's a short hike, you know, you get out and you walk a quarter mile to it, or whether it's one of these ones where you have to walk a mile and a half and have a 2,000 foot grade difference. We look at that. We look at the water hauling liability. So has it gone dry before? How big is the system? Does it adequately fit the wildlife that are using it? Whether it's the only available water around, and then the importance to all species. And we bring all that together in a matrix, and that kind of prioritizes where we want to put these things out. Recently, we have also been putting them out anytime development goes to haul or anytime that they have a repair, they're trying to put these out on the landscape so that we can get good data on those as well. Now, I was asked to talk a little bit about placement of sensors, and I think this is fascinating. There is no good place to put these things. Everybody's got their own preference. In Region 3, we like to put them in the trough. Region 2 likes to put them in the tank. And so some of the things that we think about are we going to have any people that are going to be vandalizing these things? We think about wildlife vandalizing these things. And that's not something you think about, but we have pictures of bears that sit in troughs and take baths, and they're splashing all over the place, having a grand time. But if we have a sensor in there, they're disrupting that sensor, they're banging it, they're bumping it, they're throwing it out of the trough. So in some areas, it may be wiser to have these things in the tank where wildlife can't impact them. In places here like Mojave County, we don't have a ton of bears, knock on wood, running around. And so having them in the trough has worked just fine for us, and we'll keep them in the trough. Other things to think about is what kind of system is it? There's lots of systems out there, and one that comes to mind is float valve systems. And so in a float valve system, your tank might be at 5%, but your trough is going to be at 100%. And so if you put your sensor in the trough, okay, great, you got 100%, but you have no idea the level of your tank. So you may want to put the sensor in the tank for that particular one. So there is not a standard across the state for where these need to go. We really have to look at them on a case-by-case basis, determine on the wildlife use, determine if there's going to be any people issues, and then make a decision from there. We've also tried, it's really Region 4, have done a lot of exploration of additional RanchBot type equipment that can go out here. So we have RanchBot lights. Some of our catchments and our potholes are in a place where the solar panels don't get enough energy to keep powering the system. So the RanchBot light basically is the same thing, except it runs off a battery. So we've got a few of those around the state where we're running off of batteries rather than solar. We also have potholes that we monitor, and potholes are funnel-shaped. But this is not like calculus where it's really even and all the walls are very straight. So even if we have a mathematical formula, it's not going to really necessarily give us the accurate amount of water that's in that pothole. So we've been testing out cameras. We got one camera from RanchBot. Turns out the view was too narrow. It doesn't really help us with trying to see the water level. So Region 4 sent that back, and they're trying a wide-angle lens to see if they can use that to adequately monitor those potholes. We also have tank extends and trough extends. So I just used the example of the float valve and where you may want to put the sensor in the tank. We got a tank extends because a tank extends was advertised to us as tie into the RanchBot system. You can put one sensor in the tank, one sensor in the trough, best of both worlds. So we were like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. So we tried it, and then the tank extends has the data in a different format. It's not compatible with the original RanchBot, which blows my mind because it's the same manufacturer. So we sent that back, and now we are working with tank extends, which seems to have all of the data in the same format, and that way we can adequately measure what's in the tank and what's in the trough. And just a note on that, RanchBot has been wonderful. I mean, we've talked a little bit right now about them sending things back and us testing things, and they've just been great to work with and never given us any grief, so it's been nice. Next. A little bit about finances here. So fiscal year 26, we are funded for $150,000 for PFQF positions. As you recall, these two technicians, their sole job is to put out and troubleshoot any RanchBots or any other water sensors. So we have them for next year. We have $215,000 for RanchBots, $2 million for catchments, and then an additional $200,000 for HPC-funded catchments. Fiscal year 27, I don't think the budget is done yet. I'm looking at Jen Osborne. She won't meet my eyes. So we requested $150,000 for the PFQF positions again, $365,000 for RanchBots, $2.28 million for catchments. So we'll just have to wait and see what was approved and how the finances worked out with that. Next. So this map you've likely seen before. This is all the dots for the various catchments that we have across the state. We do have about 3,000 that we monitor. Whether there are man-made built ones or whether they're potholes or springs, we had about 3,000 water sources that we are monitoring. Next. And just as a review for the public who may not know about wildlife waters, here's a picture. So in this particular picture, we can see the collection apron up to the top of that picture. So idea is the rain falls on it, runs down into a gutter. The gutter will pipe that water into the tank that you see there. And then that tank is usually gravity-fed with the trough. So it's pipes over to the trough, gravity-fed, meaning that the level in the tank is going to be equal to the level in the trough. And this particular one actually has a collection point over there in that ravine where it collects water from that ravine when it rains and pipes it into the tank. All of our system, I wouldn't say all of them, many of our systems look different. And so this is just a general example of what a catchment can look like. But out on the landscape, we have lots of different ones. And we heard this morning about a PVC system. And I know Mr. Fugate's waiting to talk about PVC systems. So we'll hear a little bit more about that. But it really depends on the construction, depends on the habitat. It depends on location, depends on the amount of animals that are coming to use it, the different species. So I am going to talk about standards here in a couple of slides. But just messaging is that these may look different even moving forward with our standardization.
Supervisor Klima, I think we're going to take a break right now.
Certainly.
And then we'll come back at what time?
So what I'm told, Mr. Chairman, is that we need an hour and a half combined for the project that we need to work on and executive session. So 1:15 would be about the right time.
About 1:15. All right, we'll break and return at 1:15. And thank you for your patience. I appreciate it.
Check, check, check. 1, 2, 1, 2.
All right, we're back on.
We're back in session, and Supervisor Klima, the floor is yours again.
All right, so I think we were complete with this slide, so we'll go to the next one, please. All right, here's just some facts about water catchments. As I alluded to before, as I mentioned before, we use lots of different materials and types, and it depends on the area of the state and what animals we are servicing that the catchments change, and there's different ones scattered throughout the state. There's some examples that A through D gives you some of the examples of the different kinds we have out on the landscape. Next. Just a few things about catchments. Most of these are man-made structures, and so they sometimes are subject to failure. When it rains a quarter inch on an apron that's 48 by 120 feet, we estimate catching about 800 gallons of water from that. And then how long do these catchments last? Really, they last longer than I will be working for Game and Fish. So
you hope.
Well, I hope. The poly tanks, we're thinking 40 to 50 years-ish. PVC, up to 25 years plus. We are reprioritizing any of the really old ones or things that are leaking, damaged, or we foresee that we're going to have issues in the near future. Of course, those are prioritized higher. Next. Here's the prioritization for how we decide which catchments we are going to redevelop. 60% of that is reliability. We have to make sure that there's water available for wildlife, and so the reliability is of the utmost importance to us. Then we also take into biological factors into account, as well as department investment. We're currently funded for 28 in fiscal year 26, and this does include Marine Corps Air Station funding, which I believe is in Region 4. And the Marine Corps Air Station has also purchased ranch bots for us. Wow. Next. So this is just Region 4. Again, we're shooting for 28 next fiscal year. Those top two, Mohawk Mountains and New Water Mountains, will be development catchments. Those will be ones redone by us, and then those ones listed below will be volunteer builds. So again, just we've heard over and over Region 4 volunteer efforts and the how many people they have, and it just goes to show they're planning to do 4 catchments next year. Yeah. Next. Here's a diagram of the engineering scheme for one of our standard wildlife waters. This is the polytrough, poly tank system. It's very similar to the one that you saw, the diagram picture of the catchment when I started this section. I don't have much to say about this. You guys have probably all seen these out on the landscape. Next. PVC system is another system that we use, especially down in Region 4. Next. And if you look closely here, you may see a certain commissioner wearing a hard hat and a bright yellow vest, helping to, don't look that way, Mr. Chairman, look your other way. This actually, Commissioner Buchanan was out on that one. But this is down in Region 4, and this is one of the PVC systems that they just put in recently. Next. All right, on to costs of drought. Next. So in 2025, the blue bar represents the total cost to haul water. As you can see there, this is as of the end of April. We're already almost $1 million this year alone just for hauling water. So I anticipate when you see this graph again in December, that number is going to be quite high. And then we have spent $600,000 for redevelopments, and we are on track for the redevelopments throughout the calendar year. Next. Here are our Send Water donations, and you can see in fiscal year 25, that gray bar. We're currently at an 8% increase year over year from this time last year, and we are planning to launch the paid campaign earlier this year, starting in May, and we do typically see a large jump in donations in the last 2 months of the fiscal year. And then for commissioners that may not be aware, in fiscal year 21 is when we started the paid promotion for Send Water. That's why you see such a big jump from fiscal year 20 to fiscal year 21. We had another paid advertising in fiscal year 22, which is why that bar is very high again. Fiscal year 23 and 24, we did not have paid advertising. And so the bar, you know, reduced a little bit, but obviously have made great strides, and Heidi's group have made made sure that they contacted recurring donors and past donors and made sure that those relationships were still strong. Next. And I am pleased to announce that the Yuma Regional Supervisor, Danielle Kloss, will be the new team lead. She'll be replacing me. I'm excited for her. She's going to bring a lot of great new perspectives to the team, push them probably in different directions than I have, and I'm confident she'll do a great job. Oh, Danielle's over here. All right, next. And then, as always, our metrics will be provided monthly in the CPR. Team leads will be available for questions, and then I do believe we'll be back to chat with you again, and by we, I mean Danielle, in December. If you have any questions, I'm glad to take them.
Any questions? I think we have a comment from Region 4. Blue slip. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the Commission. Back at Region 4, I have Johnny Fugate with the Yuma Valley Rod and Gun Club here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Fugate.
If you could Chairman.
If you'd state your name for us, and you've got 3 minutes, sir.
Thank you. On behalf of the club, I'm here to inform you our organization sincerely appreciates Ms. Klima's presentation, particularly the slides relating to PVC water catchments. Under the direction of the department, particularly Region 4, we are proud to inform the Commission over 100 PVC catchments have been built over the last 30 years. I would like to provide a few additional details which we feel are important. First, the very first buried catchment we built back in 92, it's called Legacy Tank, filled completely with 1/3 of an inch of rain, catching more than 11,000 gallons of water. The PVC catchments that our club assists the region in building are completed in less than 3 days from start to finish when all materials are on site. Fred Bloom, a retired department engineer, told us the buried pipe in a PVC catchment would likely last over 100 years. Fourth, PVC catchments built by our volunteers to target the recovery of Sonoran pronghorn have assisted in increasing the population of free roaming animals from 21 to over 450 since 2002. Number five, a 22,000-gallon PVC catchment cost approximately $58,000 for materials. A standard 20,000-gallon apron catchment cost approximately $148,000 for materials. And finally, the club believes PVC catchments are much more than an exception to the new standard apron and are likely appropriate designs for arid climates in regions 3, 5, and 6 as well. And I would be happy to answer any questions if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Fugate. We appreciate what you and your club do.
Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe that concludes the presentations for the Commission Priority Report.
Very good, Luke. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, item 11 is request for referral to OAH, presenter Patrick Boyle, Assistant Attorney General.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Commissioners. Good to see you guys. It's been a minute. So the department has requested Patrick Boyle, Attorney Assistant Attorney General, for the record. The department has requested the Attorney General's office to seek civil suspension and or revocation of the guide licenses for Jay Lopeman and Chad Roten pursuant to ARS Section 17362 regarding potential violations of Title 17. The department recommends that the commission refer this matter to the Office of Administrative Hearings to conduct a hearing and prepare a report and recommendation to the commission.
That's your recommendation, sir?
Yes.
I have a recommendation from the department as stated by Mr. Boyle. Is there any discussion other than what we've already discussed in on this matter? Is there a motion in support of that recommendation? Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Boyle. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, item 12 is approve a cooperative agreement for law enforcement efforts. Presenter is Gene Elms, Law Enforcement Branch Chief.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, the Department is requesting approval for a cooperative law enforcement agreement between Arizona Game and Fish Department and partner states. Further details of this agreement we have discussed in executive session. I have a recommendation if you'd like.
Please, sir, go ahead.
The department recommends the commission vote to approve the cooperative agreement for law enforcement efforts with the participating parties.
So moved. So I have a motion by Vice Chair Sue and a second by Commissioner Buchanan to accept that recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Chief.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to point out for the record that I have had three agenda items today for a total of 9 minutes. Thank
you. That is for the record.
And perhaps we could put you in charge of budget next.
Nice. Mr. Chairman, item 13 is special big game tag reallocation. Presenter Andrew Cavalcant, Habitat Partnership Committee Coordinator.
Before we hear from Mr. Cavalcant, I think we need to go back into executive session, Andrew. I apologize for that. So I'm not going to make a motion. I think we're just going to go back into executive session.
Motion to move to executive session.
I have a motion and a second to go into executive session. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, item 13, special big game tag reallocation. Presenter Andrew Cavalcant, Habitat Partnership Committee Coordinator.
Before you begin, Mr. Cavalcant, Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Kerr is going to recuse himself from the conversation on the vote.
Very well, we'll come and get you when we're done. Mr. Cavalcant, go ahead.
All right, good afternoon, commissioners. Glad I could finally get up here. My name is Andrew Cavalcant, and I'm the Habitat Partnership Committee Coordinator. And today I'll be presenting on the Arizona Elk Society Special Big Game Tag Reallocation. Next slide, please. All right, so I know most of the commission is very familiar with the Special Big Game Tag program, but for the audience, I'm gonna spend a little bit of time kind of doing an overview of the program. So under statute and rule, the Arizona Game and Fish Commission may award special big game tags to a nonprofit wildlife conservation organization to be sold. Now, all revenue generated from the sale of these tags is donated back to the department where 100% of the proceeds fund habitat enhancement and wildlife projects benefiting Arizona's big game species. These tags are awarded annually by the commission based on written applications from these WCOs. And one thing I'd like to note, that this is a commission-directed process. The department's role is to facilitate the commission's decision. Next slide, please. All right, so here I'm going to go over the special big game tag timeline. And for an example, I'm going to go over the 2026 and 2027 special big game tag season. This starts with the application period, which is open right now, from March 1st to May 31st. And this is where the department solicits and receives applications, ensuring they meet requirements, and submits them to the commission for review. This is followed by tag allocation. This is where the department presents applications to the commission, typically during the June commission meeting for tag allocation. After this, we have the sale of the tags, which these tags are sold by organizations after and only after they sign an agreement with the commission. And these tags are sold from as soon as the agreement is in place all the way up to the start of that tag season, which is August of 2026. And this is followed by the hunting season. So for the 26 and 27 special big game tag season, this is from August 15th, 2026 to August 14th, 2027. And while this is going on, there's an overlap from the sale of the 2025 and 26 special big game tags. Next slide, please. All right, so I'm going to talk about the special big game tag agreements, which I think is important for this conversation we're having today. So a formal special big game tag sale agreement must be executed between the awarded WCO and the commission. This agreement outlines responsibilities for the WCO, and this is things such as requirements for marketing, financial reporting, tag issuance, and assuring compliance with statute and rule. And another important clause in there for today's discussion is that a special big game tag will be sold as described in the awardee's application. Next slide. All right, so why are we here? During the June 2024 commission meeting, the Arizona Elk Society was awarded one elk special big game tag for the 2025 and 2026 season. Per their application, Arizona Elk Society committed to auctioning the tag at their 2025 banquet with a backup plan to offer the tag to the next highest bidder in case of a default. So on April 5th, 2025, the Arizona Elk Society went ahead and auctioned their tag at their banquet, which received $325,000. Well, soon after this, the original winning bidder later withdrew from the sale. Arizona Elk Society then offered the tag at the same price as the next highest bidders, and which all declined. So after exhausting all approved tag sales efforts within their application, the Elk Society immediately contacted the department to discuss alternatives, seek guidance, and assure compliance with the appropriate steps. Next slide. So the Arizona Elk Society is requesting commission approval to sell the 2025 and 2026 elk special big game tag either directly to a qualified buyer at the original auction price of $325,000 or through an online auction if the direct sale is not completed. And I would like to note that Arizona Elk Society will cover all marketing and auction related costs for this. These methods were not specified in the original application, and this is why we're here today. Historically, Arizona Elk Society has been awarded two elk tags, and one auctioned at their banquet and the other through this online auction. Below the table gives a summary of the Elk Society's revenue for these two means. Next slide, please. All right, so as I talked about in the beginning of this presentation, this is a commission-owned process, and we're here just to help facilitate the commission decision, so I will not be making a recommendation. However, the commission may consider whether to approve Arizona Elk Society's proposal request to sell the 2025 elk special big game tag directly to a qualified buyer at the original auction price of $325,000, offer the tag through an online auction, or attempt the direct sale first, followed by the online auction. And that is it for me.
I want to make one thing clear, as I understand it. You can confirm this with me. These tags come from the commission, but if they are not auctioned or not sold, they return to the department, and the department will do whatever they want or whatever they can with them, or they're just not sold at all. Is that your understanding?
Chairman, from my understanding, I don't believe the return to the department is returned to the commission, but I would need Jim, if you can help me out with that. Yes. So this being a commission process, these tags aren't ever technically owned by the department. We just help facilitate it.
Okay.
Mr. Do you have a comment? I was going to make a motion, but if you have a comment.
I do. Yeah, so just, again, for clarification, I want to make sure that I understand this and also the public does. First of all, we may award up to 30 big game, special big game tags per year. We don't have to award all 30. Second thing is last year, the period when we made this decision in June of 2024, we did award 30. And I'm trying to verify that I understand all this properly. One of those was not dispensed of in the way in accordance with the application process and the approved process. So then it comes back to us for a decision, to the commission, not to the department, for a decision about what to do about it. And, you know, essentially we have the three options that you laid out, or the option to return it as an unused tag to the department. We don't have an option to do something different with it. From my perspective, at least of ourselves, we could return it, but we can't as a commission, because we already made a decision on it back in 24. We can't open up a new process for this tag, correct?
Chairman, Commissioner Buchanan, you are correct.
Okay.
And that was said much better than the way I asked the question, but you're exactly right. That's what I was trying to get at. Commissioner Guggenhauer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I would just add on to Commissioner Buchanan's comments that this is really a unique situation for a couple of reasons. The first is it could set a precedence that we could see future requests to change after decisions have been made. I could just see it adding more confusion to our system going forward if we had this appeal process in place, if you will. And the second thing is, everybody knows that a year ago the commission decided to end the format of a auction to sell these tags. So with those two things in mind, Mr. Chairman, I make a motion that we do not issue this tag, that we withdraw this tag and just return it, or just keep it in inventory.
I have a motion to deny this request and return the tag to the department by Commissioner Buchanan, and a second by Vice Chairman Sue. Before we vote on that, is there anything else, Council, that needs to be included in that? I'm sorry. It is Commissioner Buchanan.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to correct the motion was Commissioner Guggenhauer. Yeah.
Correct.
I have nothing further.
I have a motion again by Commissioner Guggenhauer, seconded by Vice Chair Sue. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Commission approves it unanimously, 4-0. Mr. Director.
Mr. Chairman, that brings us to item 17, Chairman, Commissioners, and Director comments. We remembered him.
We remembered him. We didn't think we were. Give him some water.
Wake him up. Yeah, I will have a comment.
What did I miss?
I want to start by thanking all the folks that were involved in the workshop yesterday. It was wonderful. I know that there were a bunch of folks here and probably not here that participated in getting that thing to run as flawlessly as it did. So I want to extend my thanks to all of you for that. I also want to thank Commissioner Buchanan for his sampling yesterday of various items at the hotel following our workshop. It was incredibly generous and enjoyed by all. And I will turn it over to whoever's next. Commissioner Guggenhauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a couple of comments along with the thanks and gratitude. Last weekend up in Payson, we held the Payson Wildlife Fair. It was absolutely a huge success. Probably 5,000-ish people show up for this thing. The Game and Fish Department plays a big role there. Lots of displays, lots of work that goes in, and most importantly, a lot of planning to help execute that fair up there. So it was very well attended, and I thank the regions that were there that went in with that. We heard earlier today some comments about water hauling and some of the WCOs paying for or portions of these water haulers. They're about $19,000 to $20,000 each. So these are not minor investments that are being made. And I'm happy to say that the Wildlife for Tomorrow organization, which is the 501c3 partner with the Arizona Game and Fish Department, was able to identify a $5,000 donation to go towards the purchase of these three water haulers. So thanks a lot to all the WCOs that contributed to this, but I personally recognize the Wildlife for Tomorrow for their efforts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Sue, no? Mr. Buchanan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I've got two comments. First one, you know, we just talked about allocation and disbursement of special big game tax. And if you looked at the bar chart for where we are facing, where we're headed next, we've got application period right now that's underway, and the applications are due the end of this month. Then we have a short turnaround until we actually make our decision at the June meeting in Payson. But I want to encourage all of our WCO partners to look hard at this. We have had many, many years of great partnership with our WCOs in helping to raise money for habitat and other management of these 10 big game species, but it's not obviously just going to benefit them. It'll benefit all wildlife. And for those of you that didn't follow the logic in last year when we rendered our decision about auctions, it was really about staying consistent with the values enshrined in the North American model of wildlife conservation. And so even though auctions are off the table, we encourage people to roll up their sleeves and figure out how we can work together to do this great work for the benefit of wildlife and its management in our state. So please think about it, and if you have a plan, even if you're a non-traditional WCO or you haven't participated in the past, reach out to the department and consider applying by the end of this month. Second comment's really about commission priorities. We had a great presentation today, and thanks, Supervisor Klima, for all your hard work and your leadership over the past couple of years on this specific priority and how it's changed and evolved over time. But I think the bigger issue is how this department then takes those priorities and treats them in a very serious way. I've been in organizations where somebody's guidance or their values or their priorities made a nice poster on a wall, but they didn't really count for anything. And that is not the case here. Every single month that we have a commission meeting, we take one of those priorities and dig into it in depth. The lead will then report back on all the matrix, and it keeps us, the commission, apprised about what's going on. But it also keeps the department, it helps shape the department's effort. The department does many, many things that are not directly associated with those priorities. But this is the five of our responsibility, our ability to help shape behavior in the department. To that end, we had a great workshop yesterday. We discussed some priorities. We tossed around some ideas. And we may see some change in the future. But I look forward to getting a thoughtful presentation, not just about an additional, but also a critical look at our priorities to make sure that we have all the right things that we, the commission, thinks are important to help guide the department's behavior. That's it. Thanks.
Commissioner Kerr.
Thank you, Chairman. Last month, I had the privilege of going to the Commissioner's Cup, which is the Arizona State Clay Target Shooting Championship. It was held at Ben Avery. And it's kind of run by the SCTP, the Scholastic Clay Target Program. And since its inception, it's done a great job of, it instills responsibility, teaches firearm safety, teaches teamwork, and really builds self-confidence with these kids. It's really cool. It's a level playing field. I was really excited to see that the three-girl team from Xavier High School beat all the boy teams in the Skeet Championship, so hats off to them. So it really is kind of a level playing field where co-ed teams exist throughout the program. And I want to give out a shout out to all the volunteers. There's a ton of volunteers work that goes into this, whether you're just a parent out there driving your kid and pressing the button to throw the targets, or you're one of the volunteer coaches. And it's really creating a great opportunity for the youth of Arizona and the United States. So with that, I'd like to give a shout out to Megan Lopez, who is the person in charge, and her team. I'm sure we're all familiar with the picture of the duck that looks so calm on top of the water, and underneath those little feet are paddling like crazy. She was throwing a couple of curveballs where I believe the Tucson facility could not host one of the events, and it was just seamless the way she was able to make a venue change and get the information out, and she really did a great job. So, well, with that, I'll just say it was a great experience, and it has been for as long as I've been involved. So please extend my congratulations to Megan. She did a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Director?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. Wanted to also thank the region for arranging all of this. There's definitely a different culture in every community we go to, and always enjoy coming back to Kingman and Mojave County because people show up and they're really interested in what we do. I know it's a lot of work to put that together and a lot of work from some of the people in the director's office too. Also wanted to point out the security folks that come and do this every time. Thanks for being here and doing the job so well that you do. And then IT, we already mentioned what it's like to make that happen, but thank you all for crawling all over, rewiring things, et cetera, today and everything. Every time you do it, and you don't have to do that, really appreciate it. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Number 18, item 18 is future agenda items and action items, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Director, we did not capture specific action items that were voted on today, but we do have a couple follow-ups, in particular the item just offered by Commissioner Buchanan regarding future agenda topic presentation regarding commission priorities and a more in-depth discussion, as well as some of the pieces from yesterday's workshop. So.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, item 19 is the litigation report.
Nothing further to report.
Perfect. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman, for this agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion to adjourn.
I have a motion to adjourn from Commissioner Guggenhauer, a second from, for one more meeting, Vice Chairman Sue. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Thank you all very much.